Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, an extended edition, a three-hour special on the pain, profit, and politics of vaccines. It was just a week ago that I did a two-hour special with Bonnie Faulkner of the program, highly respected and played throughout the United States, on vaccines in the state of California and why the state has been so insistent that they have mandatory vaccines with no exclusions. Today we're going to look at vaccines from a larger perspective. And also we're going to hear from voices from within the vaccine community. Virtually all the individuals that you'll be hearing today were at one time pro-vaccine, including the physicians. We will have Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, board-certified nephrologist and an internist who has practiced conventional allopathic medicine for years. She is a founding board member of the International Medical Council on Vaccination. That's an association of doctors, nurses, and medical professionals in the community. She is also one of the few people who have not only been pro-vaccine, but only became challenging vaccines when she found that her patients coming in for dialysis and other kidney treatments were receiving a routine hospital vaccination and becoming sickened, so sick that she could find no other reason except for the vaccines as causing it. And she insisted to the hospital not to give mandatory vaccines until after their treatments. That began a interesting crusade for her. She took 5,000 hours, that's years, of in-depth investigative research, scholarship, and the more she looked, the more concerned she became. So much so that in time, she was to co-author a book with Roman Bistrinic called Dissolving Illusions, Disease Vaccines and the Forgotten History, which provides the most in-depth historical review and analysis to date about vaccine failures during the past 200-plus years and the reasons why vaccines have not been shown to be safe and effective. She will be joined by Dr. Nancy Banks. Dr. Banks is a trained obstetrician, gynecologist, and she is also has background in gynecological oncology from Harvard Medical School. And she has practiced general obstetrics and gynecology for over 25 years. Dr. Banks also has an MBA in finance, and she has conducted a lot of research into the subject. And she will also be sharing her opinion concerning vaccines and their safety. And they will both be joined by other doctors in the field on the subject of vaccines. And before we get to the other panelists, let me share some thoughts from some people within the vaccine community. All these people at one time were pro-vaccines, and these are from parents. And here are some of the issues that they are concerned about. Why are newborn babies vaccinated on their first day of life against a disease that is primarily transmitted sexually and by needles in drug users? In fact, pregnant women are already tested for sexually transmitted disease prior to birth, so there's no reason to give it to an infant. Interesting to note, the few vaccines that still are given to infants and still has thimerosal in it is hepatitis B and the diptet and flu shot recommended to pregnant women. So the claim that it has been removed from all vaccines is not true. And if they give it to all newborns, then all the newborns are getting thimerosal, a mercury derivative. And yet we were told, quote, it was removed from many childhood vaccines in 2002, but remains in some vaccines, including hepatitis B vaccine. So then they're asking a legitimate question. And all the legislators in the state of California, as well as in all other states, since this proposition in California, the law they're trying to enact in California and seem to be succeeding in, are vaccines safe and effective? they haven't even asked that question, let alone brought in people who have experience to answer it. The people that they bring in are lobbyists or people who have some form of ideological, political, or financial connection to the vaccine industry. And therefore, they're not hearing, except on the streets, from the citizens. They want to take away all exemptions. But this same law is being pushed in all 50 states. And we also know that behind this push is the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. For 35 years, no one knew that ALEC even existed, except for the 200 to 300 corporations that work together, lobbying state legislators once or twice a year, giving them written bills written by corporate councils, and then given by the lobbyists and said, here, state legislator, take this back to your state and pass it as law. So your legislatures have met with ALEC and passed 22,000 laws that we know of. How many more we don't know of, they could be much more than that. So an awful lot of the laws that benefit the corporations involved and do not benefit citizens are passed by ALEC, and yet this was all done in secret. And we should challenge that. So if they want to give a mercury-related vaccine and hepatitis B to a child that doesn't have hepatitis, what is the point? Then why are babies given vaccines to produce antibodies when they do not produce antibodies until age 3 to 6 months? And they do get required antibodies naturally from breastfeeding. And why does the government tell parents to delay breastfeeding and get more vaccines when breastfeeding babies produce higher levels of antibodies? And why aren't vaccine manufacturers held responsible when their product injures your child? Why would these companies need to be protected from the effects of such wonderful products? If they're that safe and that effective, then why one special exemption from responsibility? And yet they do that. And yet the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that exempting the vaccine manufacturers from all liabilities is done under the explicit understanding that they fall under the category of, quote, unavoidably unsafe products. Well, if they're unavoidably unsafe, then what about the millions of Americans with compromised immune systems, individuals who have AIDS-defining illnesses or who have autoimmune conditions like arthritis? Or what about those who are senior citizens and suffering from severe immune dysfunction? They're still given vaccines. No one asks before they give a vaccine, do you have a precondition that would prevent you from receiving this? And why have no double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials been done on any vaccines? And yet all other drugs, whether in psychiatry, in let's say, oncology, rheumatology, gastroenterology, if you want to introduce a drug, the gold standard is you take a group of people and you give them the drug. Another group, you give a placebo, a sugar pill. You follow them for an extended period of time and see what is the difference. And unfortunately, that has not been done with any vaccine. What they call placebo is frequently just another vaccine. And why are we following the U.S. vaccination schedule? We're the most vaccinated population on the planet, yet we have the highest rate of infant deaths from sudden infant death syndrome in the Western developed world? And why are disease outbreaks occurring in populations with 90% plus vaccination rates? We were told about herd immunity. We'll examine herd immunity. And why are children vaccinated against these diseases still catching and spreading them? And why are we frightened of non-fatal illnesses that train a child's immune system how to behave? And why are vaccine manufacturers allowed to reduce antigens and insert cheap and toxic additives that aggravate the injection site? And why do we need multi-dose vaccines if the number one priority of vaccine manufacturers is your child's safety? Why will no physician sign a written guarantee for a child's safety prior to vaccinating them with products they insist that you take and that are completely safe? So it's a catch-22. The doctor says vaccines are completely safe and effective. Then give me a letter stating I will not be injured and I will be protected from the disease. They won't do that. Then ask the government to do the same, the CDC, the FDA, U.S. Public Health Service. They won't do it. And why is there no concern when $3 billion is paid out in vaccine injury and death claims, and yet they claim there's no correlation between injury and death and vaccines? They're perfectly safe. And yet an agency of the government is paying out this money. So these are legitimate concerns. Also, the question that rises, well, didn't vaccines cause the end of polio and the measles epidemics and scarlet and other conditions such as smallpox? Well, the research shows just the opposite. Public health research charts show that by the time a vaccine was introduced, diseases were 95 to 98% gone, such as the measles vaccine. And there was no vaccine for scarlet fever, and yet it went way down. So we're going to examine in our program all of these issues, and you're going to be hearing from a wide variety of individuals. Let us go now to our first presentation with Dr. Suzanne Humphreys.
My name is Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, and I'm a medical doctor and co-author of a book called Dissolving Illusions. Up until 2011, I worked in the conventional medical system as an internist and nephrologist. Kidneys are fascinating and complicated organs, without which your blood, bones, lungs, heart, and brain won't function normally. Because of that, kidneys are really important. I want to tell you some of the things that occurred during my medical career, starting near the beginning. I set my sights on a series of goals. The university degree came first, then a 2-year stint in a cell biology lab. And then, because I wanted to work with humans, I went to medical school. On June 1, 1993, I started a residency in New York City, 1 month before the National Institutes of Health held an international workshop on current issues on vaccination, a topic that was nowhere on my radar. The published summaries and abstracts from the weekend in July reveals what some of the participants were studying. Discussions of the primitive level of the science of adjuvants, of vaccine contaminants, and unexpected adverse reactions. Interference in the normal immunologic response as a result of vaccination, shedding of revertant virulent polio viruses after vaccination, as well as dreams of future combination vaccines and new delivery systems. In 1989, I had a series of hepatitis B vaccines, after which I was unwell for some time, but never connected the dots, because all I had been taught about vaccines was that they were the greatest contribution to public health ever. After the residency, I completed a nephrology specialty in Philadelphia, then became an assistant professor of medicine, teaching various levels of doctors and students, and later moved on to a private practice in a large teaching hospital. I sat and listened to doctors who said things like, "Paul Offit says that 10,000 vaccines can theoretically be given all at once to babies, and anti-vaccine people are a threat to human survival, and aluminum is important for the growth of a healthy fetus." So those are my academic qualifications. Today, in 2015, my critics find it easier to ignore my scientific degrees and CV and choose to sneer me down by saying, "She's a quack homeopath." So let's clarify the issue. There's no denying that some people heal under the care of homeopathy. I did attend the School of Homeopathy in the United Kingdom from 2008 until 2011 while still in full-time medical practice. However, I did not complete my studies and never earned a degree. I am not and do not wish to be a homeopath. While I loved many aspects of homeopathic theory and study, homeopathy didn't work in my hands as a practitioner in training. I have no regret in doing it during my quest to broaden my understanding of disease and healing in order to give my patients something more. I do hold a bachelor's degree in physics. I am a physicist and have used physics. I am an internist and a nephrologist and have taught medical students, residents, and fellows in training. Yet strangely, the critics zero in on something I'm not even involved in and call me a quack homeopath. I find it amusing that skeptics rarely let the truth get in the way of their delusions. Back to my real world as a newly trained doctor. Little did I know that what I was taught about vaccines and immunity meant that I had absolutely no idea what I was talking about and left me blinded when confronted with the real world. And this is still the case for the majority of medical professionals today who are at the front line of patient care. I knew nothing about vaccine manufacture, contents, risks, or history. We had been told historical factoids about Jonas Salk inventing one polio vaccine and Albert Sabin the other, and that smallpox and polio were supposedly eradicated by vaccination. I certainly knew nothing about the developing immune system. After being handed the schedule of vaccines for kids during my pediatric rotations, I was told to give them on time. That was the extent of my knowledge. As a nephrologist, I gave hepatitis B vaccines to dialysis patients. Their immune systems don't respond very well, so we often had to give them numerous injections of high-dose vaccine, which is an enormous aluminum load. I gave flu shots, pneumonia shots, all per dialysis protocol, never considering any potential problems. Nothing was linked to vaccines in my mind until one patient in 2009 volunteered to me. I was fine until I had that flu shot. And I thought, well, that can't be. But the other doctors and I could find no alternative cause. Until 2009, I had never once considered vaccines as a potential threat to kidney health. This was my sentinel case. A man who had normal kidneys documented by blood work prior to December, then was vaccinated in his doctor's office and came to the hospital in renal shutdown 2 weeks later. He required dialysis for about 3 weeks and then was taken off of dialysis, but his kidney function only returned to about 70%. I want to show you a sampling of some other cases that I made record of after that first eye-opening event, when I began to ask the simple question, when was your last vaccine? This 69-year-old man had documented normal kidney function prior to getting his swine flu shot mid-December and developed kidney failure. He stopped making urine and had dangerously high potassium levels and acid buildup within 4 weeks. He was placed on dialysis and died 1 month later after having a massive stroke. Then another man came along with normal kidney function. He got an H1N1 and seasonal flu vaccine in mid-December 2009 and came to the hospital about 4 weeks later with severe nephrosis, losing massive amounts of protein from his urine. His kidney filtering capacity was also down by about 20% from his former baseline. He was treated by me for 2 years with heavy-hitting immunosuppressive medicines without much improvement at all. On discussing my cases at our practice, my colleague pulled this file from 2005 to show me. She had normal kidneys, got a flu shot in October of 2005, and developed an acute illness on the day of injection. She started dialysis 5 days later, underwent several dialysis treatments, and then regained kidney function. But as of 2009, had only about 40% of normal kidney function. This 56-year-old man had normal kidneys, then got a seasonal NH1N1 shot as separate shots in December. 4 days later, he developed nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. On January 1st, his kidneys were totally shut down and he started dialysis. He continued for 11 days and then was able to come off, but only regained about 80% of his former kidney function. Well, this might not seem like a big deal, but having a large dialysis catheter placed into the internal jugular vein and getting 11 days worth of dialysis with all the inflammation that dialysis causes in the body really is a big deal. Add to that the drugs and chemicals required during and between dialysis treatments, and the costs are hundreds of thousands of dollars each time this happens. Because of seeing several patients with kidney failure after outpatient vaccines, I started looking at what happened in the hospital after vaccines. This is a patient who had mild renal impairment and was admitted for an unrelated issue. He was given the quadruple strength flu vaccine for the over 65 age group on the fourth hospital day. On the graph, you'll see it is denoted there as 9/25. He developed kidney failure within 24 hours, and I was consulted at that time. It took several months for his kidneys to settle back down, but they only returned to about 60% of his former baseline. This woman had a ruptured intestine. She was operated on and did well postoperatively. Then 5 days later, she was given two vaccines, one for influenza and one for pneumococcus, upon which her kidneys shut down and she was started on dialysis. She regained about 60% of her kidney function and was discharged to the rehabilitation service, only to return a few weeks later with new onset seizures. She died in the hospital. As nephrologists, our patient base is typically one of very serious illness, often with numerous comorbidities. So when dealing with these people, there's always that question mark. Are we just seeing the anomalies of a constantly sick population base? Well, that question was answered when I thought back to a situation a year or so previous when I had taken care of two healthy people who were told vaccinations were a necessary part of hospital employment. One lady was hired in the kitchen and had a severe glomerulonephritis after the varicella or chickenpox vaccine. The other lady also had a severe glomerulonephritis after the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. The MMR vaccine-injured employee was still on dialysis in 2011 when I left. She was doing quite poorly after being otherwise healthy with no known medical problems. To begin with, I thought that it was an unfortunate thing, one of those one-in-a-million cases that we hear about. But as the numbers of patients who said to me, I was fine until I had that vaccine, increased, I got concerned. Then, after the swine flu vaccine was introduced as policy on admission to the hospital, which often confused my ability to diagnose the problems they were admitted with, more questions filled my head. So that was what I saw with my own two eyes and what my own patients were telling me. Any other time a drug was even a possibility for causing a kidney problem, there was no resistance by my colleagues to stopping that drug. Kidneys are so important that you never take a chance with them unless a life is in immediate jeopardy. Hospital-acquired acute kidney failure carries a 50% mortality rate. The answer seems simple, doesn't it? Don't vaccinate sick people in the hospital. Knowing that I would not be able to stop the vaccines altogether in hospital patients, I simply placed a do not vaccinate order on my patient charts with kidney disease whom I was consulted upon. I asked the administration to delay vaccines until discharge day. Doesn't this seem reasonable? Well, little did I know. In 2001, I was idealistic and naive. I thought that those involved in policymaking, especially the ones whom I knew for years, would want to do what is best for patients over and above what policy dictated. How wrong I was. The hospital policy was to vaccinate as many patients as possible on the first hospital day. A pharmacist would go into the patient's room, show them one sheet of paper from the Centers for Disease Control with limited and biased information, and offer them two or more vaccines. If the patient consented, which most did, an order was put into the computer with the attending physician's name, often before the doctor had even seen the patient or a diagnosis had even been made, and the nurse would give that vaccine. Sometimes the order had my name on it, even though I would not have ordered the vaccine. I was not happy, and I decided to speak to the hospital management about what I was seeing. One day in the corridor, I bumped into the chief of medicine. He asked me how things were going, and I detailed my concerns to him. And according to him, I was the only doctor seeing these problems. He kept responding as if the science was settled. I got the full-on historic justification. Oh, but vaccines have eradicated smallpox, polio, meningitis, as if that had any relevance to vaccinating sick adults, some of whom were at death's door in the hospital. So I put my concerns in writing, and meetings were held to discuss the issue, but I wasn't invited to those meetings. The result? I was told that acutely ill inpatients would continue to be offered vaccines on arrival at the hospital. I asked myself, exactly what is the science that says that these vaccines are safe for really sick people? There must be studies on the subject and writings in the medical literature in order for these doctors to be so sure of the rightness of their policy. After all, it's science we're talking about, isn't it? And the science is supposed to be all settled on the safety and effectiveness of vaccines. Because the hospital policies were centered on flu and pneumonia vaccines, this was where my research started. I submitted a written report to the administration. In my research, I found that aluminum in vaccines is a documented cause of granuloma formation, something I had been familiar with for years. Aluminum is in the following vaccines: DTaP, some HIB, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, hepatitis B, all combination DTaP, HIB, T, Tdap, or hepatitis B vaccines, hepatitis A vaccines, and human papillomavirus vaccines. Aluminum and mercury given together have synergistic toxicity. My patients who received flu shots and pneumonia shots would have received both. Can patients be assured that their renal, interstitial, granulomatous, or autoimmune illness is not due to the aluminum or molecular mimicry from a previous vaccine? Moreover, I found that my patient population with acute and chronic illness had barely been tested for vaccine efficacy, safety, or long-term consequences. So the answer, of course, is no. Patients cannot be assured of safety. Some documented ill effects of vaccines upon kidneys include autoimmune kidney disease, vasculitis, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura, and aluminum-mediated granulomatous issues. So I discussed all this evidence for over a year with the administration and with my various colleagues. Other doctors were starting to change their previously set minds, and a high number of nurses were catching on. But then, because the hospital administration could not rebut my arguments, they called upon an expert to set me straight. He never addressed any of my questions regarding acute kidney patients or acutely ill new admissions. He gave me a list of studies showing that some vaccines raise antibody levels in most immunosuppressed people with HIV or kidney failure. His argument was that ipso facto, for acutely ill kidney patients with sepsis, heart attacks, Guillain-Barré syndrome, cancer, urinary tract obstruction, nephrosis, and so on, vaccines were also perfectly safe. His letter was quite bizarre. I kept thinking, and this is the expert? Why can't he answer my specific concerns? Where is his proof that side effects don't happen to my patients? Nowhere could I find studies that looked at vaccines in acutely ill patients commonly seen by nephrologists. Even my pro-vaccine colleagues agreed that there was no scientific basis to give these injections so quickly upon admission, and they supported my motion to have the policy changed to vaccinate on discharge day. At the same time, the hospital turned up the heat on me. My progress notes and hospital charts were reviewed, which was something totally new to me. Nobody had ever before challenged my integrity or my patient care. I was then told by the administration that in order to support my outrageous claims, I should do my own study, a chart review study. I should submit it for peer review in order to prove it. But aside from doing one's own study, where would you initially go for case histories? Where I had just been, the medical literature, right? When I referred dozens of published case histories and expert peer-reviewed opinions to the hospital administration, I was told by the consultant that case reports in minor journals mean nothing. And even in major journals, case histories are just anecdotal. In his letter, the expert criticized my citation of non-American journals and that of my 47 medical references, one was from a Japanese journal. He insinuated that my argument about what I was seeing in my hospital was invalid because I searched the world's literature in order to make my point. He said that because there was no published data sets showing influenza vaccines caused kidney ailments, that my suggestion to exercise caution vaccinating acutely ill patients was unwarranted. The executive committee of my hospital also told me that it was not appropriate for me to stop vaccination orders on my patients and that I was confusing the nursing staff. I thought, how bizarre. Nurses are never used to the same treatment plan for all patients, ever. My experience was not one of confusing nurses at all, but of finding other vaccination-critical people on the hospital staff who agreed with me. Among the nursing staff, there were more allies than I would have ever imagined. Furthermore, the hospital administration argued that evidence for benefit of vaccination is overwhelmingly positive and evidence from harm is negligible. Nobody in the hospital ever addressed my specific arguments. All I got was sound bites. Vaccines are safe and effective. Smallpox was eradicated by vaccines. Polio was eliminated by vaccines. After I left the hospital, this article by Dugal came out, as have several others which implicate flu shots in the genesis of autoimmune and vasculitic diseases. But in 2011, I didn't have this article. Even if I had put this in front of the executive committee of the hospital, their attitude was that the science was settled. Case reports mean nothing. Dugal's co-author told me personally that she is now taking vaccine histories on all her renal patients. All doctors should do the same, but it's rarely done because doctors have no idea about the immunology and toxicology involved in vaccinating. Dugal was saying what I had seen with my own eyes and reported to the administration, that an increase in autoimmune disease activity has been described after influenza vaccination, and he recommended careful assessment of the risk-to-benefit ratio, which I had done, yet the hospital overrode me and my expertise. Apparently, once a policy is established, professional opinion doesn't matter. Let's look at the cases Dugal described. The last two cases here are his, and the other ones are from the medical literature. There are patients with vasculitis involving the brain, lungs, kidneys, and intestines within weeks of vaccination, some of whom developed new diseases and some whom simply relapsed. Patients with vasculitis and underlying autoimmunity are not informed of the known risk to them in vaccinating. Instead, they're persuaded and reassured that the benefit outweighs the supposedly small risk and usually believe that the doctor knows best. Note the pattern here, though. Kidney failure 2 to 4 weeks after injection, requiring highly toxic drugs to treat these vasculitides. These were things I was seeing happen to some of my patients after vaccination in the past, and today I get messages from parents all over the world telling me how their child's kidneys became diseased after vaccines. And just last month, I got a note from a woman whose spouse with kidney disease, who was very stable, died at home one day after receiving two vaccines. She was extremely distressed, and I had no comforting words for her. Since leaving the hospital in 2011, more literature has been published besides Dugal that supports my hypothesis and my experience that common and difficult-to-treat kidney diseases can be caused and worsened by vaccine ingredients. This 2011 New England Journal of Medicine article titled "Early Childhood Membranous Nephropathy Due to Cationic Bovine Serum Albumin" details the association between circulating cationic bovine, meaning cow, serum albumin, and a very difficult to treat form of kidney disease called idiopathic membranous nephropathy. Membranous nephropathy is a serious condition of the kidney filters in pediatrics and is more common in adults. Long-term prognosis is unknowable for certain, but approximately 50% of patients develop progressive kidney disease. The authors must be aware that they hit upon a very touchy subject since they implicate immunization in the body of the article, but conclude by simply saying, if bovine serum albumin is detected in kidney biopsy specimens, eliminating it from the diet could be beneficial. What the authors don't say is that eliminating direct injection of bovine serum albumin at the same time as injecting aluminum adjuvant may be beneficial in preventing the susceptible child or adult from developing this type of kidney disease. The following list of BSA-containing vaccines could possibly be very problematic to some people. BSA is used to feed the live animal or human cells that propagate the virus or bacteria during vaccine culture production. The implications of this article, in my opinion, are enormous in terms of potential adverse responses to vaccines that contain bovine serum albumin, but also to aluminum, viral, and bacterial antigens. How much adult or childhood nephrotic syndrome is caused by vaccine ingredients? The issue isn't addressed in medical literature. What clinicians see doesn't necessarily count. And how many of these vaccines are given at the same time? Often 8 vaccines are given at once to children at 1 year of age, most of which contain bovine serum albumin and aluminum, which, by the way, is added to enhance the inflammatory properties of the vaccine to the vaccine antigens. Here are the aluminum-containing ones. The asterisk at the bottom indicates overlap of bovine serum albumin and aluminum. There is plenty of writing in the medical literature about how one-size-fits-all vaccine programs give variable results even in healthy people, and how they can trigger serious inflammation and autoimmunity. There's more reason, in my opinion, to believe vaccines are not only dangerous, but also less effective in sick people. For instance, one day when I was on rounds, I went in to check on someone who was having plasmapheresis, which is a procedure designed to remove antibodies from the blood. He had kidney failure, and when I saw he had just received an influenza vaccine, I was astounded, and I said to my colleagues and the referring physician who was with me, Can you see the problem with this? Well, everyone found somewhere else to look. Around the same time, I went in to see a 27-year-old young man with lymphoma and acute kidney failure who was in the middle of a chemotherapy infusion. And in front of him was the pink CDC information sheet for the flu shot and the pneumococcal vaccine, which he had just consented to. I said to him, "Have they given the vaccine to you yet?" And he said, "No." So I immediately canceled the vaccination order. These two incidents typify the events which were occurring at the time and were the clinical issues that set me on today's divergent path. If someone had just used logic and agreed with me that you don't vaccinate critically ill patients and accepted the evidence in front of their own eyes that the vaccines were causing problems, then maybe I would still be at the hospital today. When you've walked away from people you really care about and a job you've loved, it's only natural that you would review the situation and ask questions like, could I have found more information which would have stopped very sick people from being vaccinated shortly after being wheeled into the hospital? I started thinking back to things that are crucial in nephrology, like water. In every dialysis unit, there's one person employed whose main job is water maintenance. He came in earliest every day to make sure the dialysis water didn't have anything toxic, including aluminum in it. The tanks were cleaned out frequently, and the water was kept very pure. Why? Because aluminum is known to be dangerous for patients on dialysis. Why? Because the gut excretes most orally ingested aluminum, but the minute you bypass the gut with aluminum injections, aluminum causes big problems in kidney patients. In the past, the water used for dialysis contained enough aluminum to cause problems. We used to, and in some cases still do, use oral medicines in dialysis patients that contain aluminum. Even though aluminum via the gut is safer, we don't like doing it. A person with good kidneys can get rid of most of the absorbed aluminum, but our kidney patients can't. However, if the phosphate levels threaten a dialysis patient's health, oral aluminum will bind and excrete it, but the patient may retain some of that aluminum because of compromised kidney function. So here we were taking all of the aluminum out of the water and shifting away from aluminum-containing phosphate binders as much as we could, but we were willing to inject these people with aluminum-containing vaccines. For instance, two rounds of hepatitis B injections, which may not even have a protective effect, will have 3,000 micrograms of aluminum in it. So what are some of the problems known to be caused by injected aluminum? Aluminum is a neurotoxin that inhibits more than 200 biologically important functions and causes various adverse effects in plants, animals, and humans. All those years, I knew what a great binder aluminum was for phosphate in the gut, but I never thought that it could be a problem for the major energy molecule in the body called adenosine triphosphate, but it is. We know this as nephrologists, but somehow it's considered impossible for aluminum in vaccines to be able to do anything other than stimulate the immune system. We're very careful as nephrologists when treating babies. Why? Because the kidney function of babies isn't the same as adults. It's vastly reduced. But when it comes to vaccines, this reduced kidney function in infants is always left out of the discussion. Have a look at the range of normal kidney function in term babies. It's even lower for premature babies. So I looked to see what had been studied regarding aluminum in babies, and I found this. This is a study with a very good design where two-month-old infants received the usual three vaccines at once with 1,200 micrograms of aluminum. Urine was collected for 12 hours using a sticky bag for collection. Blood was also drawn at intervals. Dr. Moveses reported that there was no rise in blood or urinary aluminum over the study period. And then, she said, we were reassured to find no significant post-vaccine rise in serum aluminum level after vaccination of preterm infants with vaccines containing a total of 1,200 micrograms of aluminum. I wonder where she thought it went. I was stunned, and I asked Dr. Moveses if she was concerned that the aluminum was not excreted and blood levels did not rise. Obviously, the aluminum was retained in tissues. Her reply was, so we don't really know what happens to the aluminum at this point in time. As you said, more research is needed in this area. She is aware that there's a problem because she referred me to Kahn's 2013 article that demonstrated tissue and brain delivery of intramuscularly injected aluminum. Aluminum is also injected into many babies on the day of birth in the hepatitis B vaccines. That's 250 micrograms of aluminum at a time when kidney function is even lower than it is at 2 months. As nephrologists, we have to study the immune system because the kidney is part of the immune system. We also deal with kidney transplants and therefore have to have a very good clinical grasp of the immune system maintenance as well as suppression in order to keep the transplant from rejecting. But what I was finding out about the immune system and injected aluminum went way beyond what I understood as a nephrologist. In today's talk, I'm only able to show you a very short list of aluminum's many known disruptions to life. Please see my short YouTube video called Aluminum is Toxic to All Life Forms for a further description. The question that arose fairly early for me was, why do doctors know next to nothing about what aluminum does inside the body? What other misinformation and gaping holes in knowledge do doctors have? And had anyone ever written about the problems with vaccination? Was I trailblazing, or were there physicians who had gone before me and had endured similar resistance? I was treated by the hospital administration as an outlier with radical and unwanted views. To my astonishment, close scrutiny of medical and vaccine history showed plenty of other outliers, not just Semmelweis and Oliver Wendell Holmes of puerperal fever infamy. When it comes to vaccination issues, it's useful to know about the following whistleblowers. The first outlier on my list is Sir Graham Wilson, who wrote a book called The Hazards of Immunization in 1967. Of course, I never knew of this book in my conventional years. Sir Graham Wilson was not a nobody, nor was he considered a quack. Though he does say that he was once totally ignorant, the book was a revelation, not just because of its content, but because of the fact that Sir Wilson was only able to write the book because of contributions from people that he mentions in the preface and the introduction. First, he talks about how the anti-vaccinationists he heard of were highly emotional and irrational people. But then he learned of an opposition that had sprung up amongst scientific workers who were moved by factual evidence. He thanks a former director from Wellcome Pharmaceutical Labs, Dr. R.A. O'Brien, who had amassed records of various vaccine disasters which he felt unable to cope with, and handed them over to Sir Graham, who said that it was doubtful whether the book would have been possible without those records. He mentions other people who helped him dig out long-overlooked journals that were not obtainable elsewhere. This is what Roman and I had to do in order to write our book. So, how are practicing doctors supposed to know about vaccine problems if the literature is buried in basements and then books like Sir Graham's are tossed out from medical libraries? Sir Graham mentions a lecturer, a top health officer who was totally ignorant of the long series of vaccine accidents in the late 1800s and early 1900s because of almost complete absence of information in textbooks. Sir Graham says the large majority of accidents have never been reported in print. Why not? He says for fear of compensation claims or of giving a weapon to the anti-vaccinationists. It's risky for any medical doctor to reveal unpublished material, but it's downright dangerous to talk as an industry scientist, which is also why R.A. O'Brien waited so long after his retirement to give Wellcome's disaster files to Sir Graham Wilson. Unfortunately, because most scientists never talk, the arrogance of ignorance is prevalent in academia as well. The same situation exists today, which is why medical students and doctors are in the dark. According to Sir Graham Wilson, there were many more reports of injury and death in soldiers from vaccines than any of us know about, because they are not mentioned in the medical literature, but remained hidden in the records of vaccine manufacturers. About the same time as Sir Graham was writing his book, a doctor by the name of Joseph Anthony Morris, who worked for the Division of Biological Standards in Bethesda, Maryland, was involved in an internal struggle which would later become the subject of a published Senate inquiry. This quote can be seen on the internet, but how many people know about Dr. Morris, who is undoubtedly one of the most important whistleblowers ever to have worked at the FDA? His work has considerable historic and medical significance. The uptake of the first influenza vaccine in 1945 was very poor. Dr. Morris was headhunted by the Division of Biological Standards because of the outstanding nature of his research skills. One of his jobs was evaluation of the safety and efficacy of the vaccines. However, Dr. Morris did not turn in results favorable to the flu vaccine. When he tested it on the Caroline Islands in different populations, he found that the effectiveness was anywhere between 0% and 40%. He reported to his superiors that the vaccines lacked potency and that the side effects were significant. To his astonishment, his superiors ignored those results and released the vaccines as safe and effective. This continued between 1963 and 1970. Dr. Morris was harassed, silenced, and demoted, forced to destroy thousands of lab animals and hand over all of his records. Publications of his results were blocked, his door lock was changed, the phone removed, and visitors were screened. Like today's Merck whistleblowers, Dr. Morris said that the DBS used dubious techniques to test the vaccines and that the results were tampered with, which permitted the watered-down vaccines to be falsely labeled as more potent than they were. Unhappy that he was unable to protect the public, Dr. Morris decided to take action. Because he wasn't prepared to accept anything other than scientific fact, while his bosses ran interference to shore up the profits of drug companies, Dr. Morris hired a lawyer and went to the Senate. The result was a well-publicized hearing. In memoranda leading up to that hearing, it became obvious that other scientists were also harassed to the point where they were forced to leave the DBS. The Senate hearing, S-3419 in 1972, was conducted at the highest level, and vaccine irregularities were investigated. The hearing covered many topics raised by Dr. Morris, including SV40, flu vaccines, and the 32 useless vaccines listed here that were licensed and released by the DBS 20 years prior to this hearing. How these vaccines were made and what exactly was in them is anyone's guess. The information you see here was given to the Senate hearing by Dr. Peter Isaacson. Those vaccines, as a result of the hearing, were taken off the market. But Dr. Isaacson made a pertinent observation, that the 32 vaccines were known to cause serious side effects, and that the dollar value of vaccines sold was astronomical. Dr. Isaacson also noted, on page 349 of the public record, that physicians and scientists have a very marked discipline conceit and seem to think they can make all sorts of judgments on anything that is beyond their training. And before someone accuses me of doing the same, my comments today are based on years of real education, so that now I have what I talk about in my hand in black and white. The only reason we know about the vaccine issues in the congressional hearing in 1972 was because Dr. Toni Morris, who was about to be kicked out of the DBS for insisting that scientific principles and methods regarding vaccines be adhered to, decided to go public. According to sworn public testimony given in S-3419, memos were quietly exchanged inside the bureaucracy over dangerous vaccines and ineffective drugs. Yet nothing was done to protect the public. The Senate record also included statements from other harassed DBS scientists who had less courage than Dr. Morris, but were still prepared to give evidence to the Senate. The DBS tried but failed to fire Dr. Morris after legal challenge. As a result of the Senate hearing, the DBS was remodeled into what we know today as the FDA, and Dr. Morris was transferred there. Unfortunately, that change was just a cosmetic facelift. If you would like to listen to some videos of Dr. Morris from after he retired at the FDA, please go here. If you read the news today about whistleblowers from Merck and from the CDC, you can see that nothing has really changed. After his transfer to the FDA, influenza was still Dr. Morris's specialty. In February 1976, in Fort Dix, New Jersey, a swine flu strain was found in a soldier who died during a march. Dr. Morris was asked to help with the investigation at the same time that there was a manufactured scare over the possibility of another 1918 flu pandemic striking. But Dr. Morris found that the virus the soldier died with was just an ordinary pig virus, not a pandemic virus. It rarely infected person to person. He also found in prior years that the 1918 flu was caused by PR8, another strain of influenza that was discovered in Puerto Rico many years before. The vaccine that was created for swine flu was a hybrid between PR8 and swine flu. Why? Because they couldn't make a vaccine with that swine flu strain because it grew too slowly. So the slow-growing swine flu strain was hybridized with PR8, which meant the swine flu vaccine virus took on the fast-growing properties of the dangerous 1918 virus, and the viral antigen used in the swine flu vaccine wasn't the ordinary pig strain from the soldier, but a fast-growing hybrid. It turned out that the vaccine was both ineffective and unsafe. Again, his bosses wouldn't listen to him and told him to shut up. So he went on the Phil Donahue show and gave public lectures stating his findings. 40 million people were vaccinated. The injuries Dr. Morris predicted were a sad reality. Hundreds were reported to be paralyzed and dozens died. Guillain-Barré syndrome was a reality from the flu vaccines. The father of infectious disease epidemiology, Dr. Alexander Langmuir, confirmed that causation. By 1982, there were 1,571 lawsuits filed just for swine flu vaccine victims. This fiasco cost the government untold millions. The one thing they couldn't say was that Dr. Morris didn't try to warn anyone. The swine flu program was stopped, but not before 46 million doses of that vaccine was sold to the public. How people responded depended on their agendas. The organized crime underworld took Dr. Morris very seriously and saw an opportunity to change the power base of the mafia. Infamous mob boss Carlo Gambino took a flu shot just before he died. Apparently, someone from a rival mob heard one of Dr. Morris's lectures on the side effects. Knowing that Gambino had a heart problem and having heard that the shot was potentially dangerous for such people, a Gambino insider was persuaded to convince Gambino to take the swine flu shot, which is widely believed to have pushed him into his grave. Make of that what you want. Many pro-vaccine people today consider the 1975 swine flu vaccine incident to be much ado about nothing. However, if you talk to older adults who lived in the cities where that vaccine was widely administered, you'll see that most of those people know of or have a family member that was affected by that vaccine. The third outlier whistleblower you should know about is Dr. Bernice Eddy, also mentioned in the Senate hearing about Dr. Morris. Dr. Eddy and Dr. Morris worked on the same floor of the National Institutes of Health and were colleagues and friends. You may have heard of her work in discovering problems with the Salk polio vaccine, but did you ever hear about the early adenovirus vaccines? At her memorial service, Dr. Morris said, "One of our shared interests was the fact that adenovirus vaccines were capable of producing tumors in animals." Pursuit of this work did not receive enthusiastic support from the NIH administrators. Every obstacle placed in the path of this work was, for Dr. Eddy, an obstacle to be overcome. The result was a discontinuance of the use of adenovirus vaccines in children. Dr. Eddy was the first to notice that Salk's polio vaccine after mass manufacture was paralyzing monkeys. Her report was ignored, and the result of that was the infamous and misnamed Cutter incident. But the story of the cancer virus is even more shocking. Because their kidneys turned out to be a convenient source of cells for growth and amplification of polio virus, rhesus monkeys were imported to the United States by the millions for slaughter and experimentation through the 1950s and the 1960s. Dr. Eddy noticed that monkey kidney cell cultures would often degenerate spontaneously, even when kept under the most favorable conditions for cell survival. She suspected an unknown virus. In 1959, she skimmed cell-free liquid from the surface of monkey kidney cell cultures and injected that into newborn hamsters. Less than 4 months later, the majority, 70% of them, developed tumors. The experiment was repeated in generations of hamsters with the same results. Administrative clearance for publication of this important 1959 finding was not granted until scientists at Merck had recovered previously undetected virus in monkey kidney cell lines they were using to make polio vaccine. Samples of this virus were given to Dr. Eddy, who injected them into newborn hamsters and obtained identical results to those she had obtained in cell-free extracts 3 years earlier. She found that the virus-induced sarcomas in hamsters, not only at the subcutaneous injection site of viral inoculation, but also at a distance in the lungs and in the kidneys. When people think of polio vaccines in the 1950s, they think of the hero, Dr. Salk, and the miraculous vaccine, because the media made sure that that was how history would remember it. But from 1959 through 1961, government health officials were frantically seeking means to remove a tumor-inducing factor from polio vaccines. At the same time, these health officials were also vigorously conducting a campaign to inject contaminated polio vaccines into millions of people without telling them that it contained a tumor-inducing factor. That factor has been referred to today by one of the world's leading virologists as the perfect war machine. The Division of Biologic Standards used very similar silencing and intimidation tactics on Dr. Eddy as they did on Dr. Morris. Her laboratory was downsized and her staff was removed. She had to develop innovative and time-saving ways of completing her work. So she too was shut down for her findings instead of rewarded for potentially saving many innocent people from being injected with cancer viruses. Why is Dr. Eddy important to me? That monkey virus was called SV40. And today you can read in medical journals about the tumors and kidney diseases that have been associated with that cancer-inducing virus. SV40 is something that all nephrologists should know about, but for some reason they don't. SV40 is found in both healthy and sick people of all ages today. But people with a specific type of glomerular disease called focal and segmental glomerulosclerosis, or FSGS, which is very difficult to treat, are more likely to have SV40 in their kidneys. Ask any nephrologist about the toxic drugs used to treat FSGS and what the cure rate is, and how frustrating it is for doctors and patients alike. It is documented widely in medical literature that this kidney-trophic virus came from polio vaccines in the 1950s and 1960s, and since then has been documented to circulate in the human population. Humans can pass it to each other, and we can also pass it to our children before birth. Nephrologists today don't know much about SV40 because they're interested more in two related polyomaviruses called BK and JC, which become active in people given a transplant who have their immune systems suppressed. The possible role of SV40 in FSGS just doesn't come on their radar. But FSGS is a leading cause of idiopathic nephrotic syndrome, and most people with the disease eventually require dialysis. FSGS as a percent of the underlying disease among dialysis patients has increased 11-fold from 0.2% in 1980 to 2.3% in 2000. Just to give you a visual of what FSGS is, look at these images. A single kidney contains around 1 million nephrons, and each nephron has a filter. The circular images shown here are glomeruli, or filters in real life. They're spherically shaped. What you're looking at are stained cross-section images from human kidneys. The first one is normal, and the second and third ones show FSGS problems, which are obvious even to the untrained eye. The filters are not functioning properly, and proteins that should remain in the body leak out into the urine instead. Because of that, FSGS is associated with several other derangements in the body, like high blood pressure, edema, and lipid alterations. While SV40 virus is found in both healthy and sick people, it is known that a certain antigen from SV40 virus results in FSGS in experimental mice. We also know that human kidney is a reservoir of more than one strain of SV40 virus, and that people with kidney disease tend to have higher rates of SV40 viral shedding. This slide shows the rate of SV40 presence in urine and kidney of FSGS patients, patients with other kidney disease, and of normal healthy people. You can appreciate that the FSGS people have far higher rates of SV40 positivity. Just looking at urine excretion, you can see 41% of FSGS, 10% of other kidney disease, and only 4% of normals have SV40 positivity. Kidney biopsies, as previously shown, have the highest rates of infection in FSGS sufferers. We have seen a considerable increase in FSGS in kidneys between the 1970s and the late 1990s, which continues on today. Nephrologists see so much kidney injury from drugs like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, antibiotics, chemotherapy, and in my and others' experience, even vaccines. Research in animals and humans shows that SV40 can initiate kidney injury and can also render kidneys susceptible to injury. Most people recover clinically after drug insults, but how many patients are susceptible to drug-induced kidney damage because they harbor variants of SV40 in the kidney? SV40 is also thought to reactivate as a result of kidney inflammation and with kidney injury from various toxins. This is an area of research that is largely untouched. Medical articles state that SV40 virus was in vaccines only up until 1963. But Rizzo and Carboni in 1999 showed that with better testing, SV40 could have been detected in seed stock for vaccine manufacture long after 1963. Attorney Stanley Copps in 2000 gave evidence from legal documents that there was no guarantee that SV40 was not in Letterly's polio vaccines up until the year 2000 when Copps wrote his article. FSGS, as we have just seen, is a serious potential consequence of SV40, but equally troubling is the potential for malignant kidney transformation in those who harbor SV40. Malignant transformation of normal cells infected with SV40 is a proven reality. Enders and Shine published in the 1960s that SV40 virus causes pathology and transforms human kidney cells in culture. That means that it causes disease and cancer in those cells. And Dr. Eddy showed that hamsters injected with SV40 developed kidney tumors. After 1964, the medical literature is devoid of SV40 kidney cancer research. But kidney cancers rose significantly after 1964. Look at this astonishing increase in incidence of kidney cancer in the UK. Similar trends are documented in Europe, Canada, and the USA. You may be saying, correlation doesn't equal causation. Certainly other cofactors may exist, but the research of Dr. Eddy and the finding that SV40 transforms human kidney cells is compelling. Causation was considered by Mortimer et al. In 1981 in a New England Journal of Medicine article, which summarized the results of the largest cohort of SV40 exposed children. Over 1,000 of those children were followed. They had actually traced 87% of that population of those children in 1981. Mortimer's concluding sentence says that because of mounting complexities and obstacles in tracing the subjects, cancer surveillance was terminated when they were teenagers. According to Dr. Anthony Morris, that would not have been the time to stop this study, but really to start it. Have vaccines anything to do with this trend we see as nephrologists? Because I can tell you, nephrologists and urologists have never been so busy, and business has never been so good as it is today. If you want to know why there are so many gaps in knowledge over SV40 and cancers, like kidney cancers, ask Drs. Key and Carboni. According to them and others, the controversy over the implications of SV40 damage has paralyzed the scientific research. Drs. Key and Carboni also said that SV40 was in Italy's polio vaccine supply up until 1999. Dr. Carboni expressed his thoughts about the suppression of his findings over SV40 and tumors in an interview to Bookchin and Schumacher. Unfortunately, as Drs. Eddy and Morris would tell you if they were here, you certainly can be punished for talking science, especially if it might make the public less willing to have blind faith in the safety of all vaccine programs. Let's look at another concern of mine. In order to make enough flu vaccine to vaccinate the world and do it quickly, a new way of making flu vaccines had to be developed. Making them on chick embryos, which is the old way, is too slow and time-consuming. So the new solution is Cocker Spaniel kidney cells, which were first cultured in 1958 by Maiden and Darby. those same cells have become mysteriously immortalized. More recently, a sanitized term has been used, continuous cell lines. These cells are now deemed safe for human vaccine production. The FDA says nobody knows just how these cells were made immortal. I can only speculate, but the textbooks clearly state that an oncogenic transformation occurred and that there has been chromosomal mutation. This particular vaccine substrate just happens to be tumorigenic in humans, as stated by FDA personnel. These are screenshots from FDA documents stating that neoplastic Maiden Darby cells are used in flu vaccine production and that those cells may cause tumors in recipients. They say if the cell is not intact, it will not likely be a problem. But other FDA documents, such as PEDIN and the panel discussion among scientists in that paper, documents the real concerns discussed behind closed doors at FDA meetings regarding transferring even nanogram amounts of genetic material via injections. Tumorigenic Maiden Darby kidney cells are now used to make flu vaccines distributed in the USA, which brings me to the most recent whistleblowers. If anyone thinks hidden vaccine problems, like Dr. Morris reporting that the DBS lied about flu vaccine potency, DBS and Merck scientists finding SV40 in polio vaccines are all in the past, think again. Two of Merck's own scientists today are suing under the False Claims Act, saying that Merck lied about the potency of its mumps vaccine. The lawsuit documents list Merck's alleged efforts to defraud the United States through Merck's ongoing scheme to sell the government a mumps vaccine that is mislabeled, misbranded, adulterated, and falsely certified as having an efficacy rate that is significantly higher than it actually is. Merck allegedly did this from 2000 onwards in order to maintain its exclusive license to sell the MMR vaccine and keep its monopoly of the U.S. market. Merck attempted to have the case thrown out. It's pretty amazing when you think of the money and the medical and political power that Merck's lawyers have, yet not one of them could come up with an argument to convince the judge to dismiss the case. When you read the judgment, you get the feeling that Merck's lawyers really annoyed him. Science, in the world of Merck vaccines, could mean throwing out results that don't fit the desired outcome. It could mean throwing out evidence before the FDA comes to inspect. It could mean offering bonuses to scientists to deliver the necessary results. But what do you expect when you have the vaccine manufacturers in charge of proving that their own vaccine is potent? Science in the general vaccine research world includes placebos that are vaccines, or placebos that are carrier fluid with aluminum. Studies done on healthy people under optimal circumstances, and then those results are applied to everyone. Other outspoken journal reviewers and scientists admit that results favorable to the vaccines are built into the study designs. Anyone who has written a funding application knows that to receive money, you have to be pretty convinced that you can produce results that will enhance the aims and objectives of the financier. I knew none of this as a nephrologist, because the system makes sure that medical students don't even think to look for information that might warn them that not all is well with these one-size-fits-all vaccines. Yet that information is right under their eyes if they only knew where to look. Of course, the CDC and FDA would prefer that we all just relax and believe the authorities are looking out for us. When is the ignored science going to be taken seriously? It never will, so long as people who talk about problems are called outliers and then hounded, vilified, character assassinated, and said to have psychological problems. Another area that bothered me was, why do my patients not show the same side effects as each other? Why do vaccines seem to be tolerated by some people, and for others it can be devastating? Why do some adverse effects happen immediately, and others take weeks or months to fully appear? This bothered me greatly, because the vaccine program is a one-size-fits-all operation. The hospital gave vaccines routinely, no matter what, to anyone who consented. However, in my research, I came across a very interesting study which opened my eyes to the fact that the individual uniqueness has been totally left out of the vaccine effect equation. In 2013, Dr. Orntoff published research detailing the genetic network changes in white blood cells before and then 6 weeks after DTP booster vaccination in 8 different girls. Here's a list of the top networks altered after the vaccine, and they're listed according to their significance. The reason this study was undertaken was that DTP shots in African studies have increased the short-term death rate in vaccinees. You can probably appreciate that there's a big difference in the array of changes between these girls and why one-size-fits-all vaccination programs cannot be acceptable across the board. What this study proves is that after a vaccine, you're not just going to get a fever, good DTP immunity, and a sore arm, because different genes are activated in different people. And remember, these are just the genes measured in some white blood cells and not in the whole body. Looking at a more clear slide, this is a partial list of the top genetic networks that are altered in the 8 girls after vaccination with those DTP shots. Here's another study showing how many undesirable gene networks can become active after vaccination. This was a human study where 5 infants got the usual first 2 sets of vaccines at 3 and 5 months. Then they had their blood drawn at 6 months. Those blood cells were re-stimulated with pertussis toxin, which is a component in the DPT vaccines. The following results were noted: allergy, asthma, cancer, and immunological disease genes were upregulated. If you want to know what the immunological explanation is for the gene changes that happen after DTP and DTAP vaccines, I can't tell you, because as Dr. Orntoff said in 2013, they haven't studied it and they don't know. But if you want to follow common sense, you'll work on the principle that some gene expression changes might be an indicator of bad things to come, and the consequences of vaccination could be varied and potentially devastating. One very prominent vaccinologist, Gregory Poland from Mayo Clinic, who is also the editor-in-chief of Elsevier's journal Vaccine, has published widely. He states that the genes upregulated for an immune response are myriad, and activation patterns differ significantly between people after vaccination. The current vaccine program, according to Dr. Poland, does not allow an informed understanding of an individual's genetically determined risk for an adverse effect due to a vaccine. He's also known for saying how the current MMR vaccine is significantly troubled by primary and secondary vaccine failure, and therefore eradication under its use is not possible. He wants to develop the next generation of vaccines to try to incite a more thorough and reliable immune response to measles in very young babies. Dr. Olivia White et al. States in the journal Vaccine that vaccine side effects are more likely to involve aberrant cell-mediated immune responses. And the best testing to look at cell-mediated immunity as a measure of vaccine side effects is available, but not required or routinely used as part of safety or immunogenicity testing. Dr. White described how complicated the immune system is. The cellular and humoral immune response involves many different cell lines and communication networks within the immune system. And specific immune responses involve the coordinate activation of hundreds to thousands of genes. Dr. Kimmon corroborates Poland, White, Orntoft, and others, who states that the immune response is highly complicated and variable from person to person. Kimmon speaks to the likelihood that vaccine non-responders are also those who are more likely to be susceptible to the worst form of disease. What this means in practice is that healthy children who do respond to vaccines are the ones who would have had a good prognosis and have recovered uneventfully. Poland's research can determine the genetics involved in both vaccine antibody response and disease prognosis. But he cannot mention the implication of that, which is that the majority of parents are vaccinating their healthy children for diseases they would easily have recovered from with no complications. Nor can he tell parents that the children who do not respond well to the vaccine are the ones who will have the worst time with the disease. Individual variation is very clearly seen in kidney patients because their immune systems are much more fragile than healthy people. As nephrologists, we often land up giving dialysis patients numerous high-dose hepatitis B vaccines. Many of our patients do not develop antibodies because their immune systems don't work properly. Some of those dialysis patients got really annoyed when the antibody tests showed no response, because then they're given so many injections. Yet we can't even guarantee that these patients with no antibodies won't get the disease after they're vaccinated numerous times. Did vaccines contribute to my patients' temporally related issues because different genes got up or down regulated, just like the children who are vaccinated? Do we have any studies to show that over periods of days, weeks, or months, this is not a risk? No. But we do have genetic studies and clinical case reports that show it is possible. I believe that the kind of study Orntoff did on the children should also be done on healthy people to see whether routine vaccines are a trigger for acute kidney disease, and on kidney patients as well. I believe that clinicians should have access to such testing because patients deserve better care and better answers when policy results in unintended consequences for them. There's absolutely no doubt that vaccines are big business. This man that I mentioned earlier, Gregory Poland, is one of the most widely quoted pro-vaccine researchers. He's a professor of medicine and researcher and a motivational speaker at Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. He's also editor-in-chief of Vaccine Medical Journal. He's a man who knows a lot more about vaccines than he lets on. But what's most important to him is maximum use of current vaccines, until his research gets to the stage where his vaccine patents will come into force. Poland calls this a new golden era of personalized predictive vaccinology, where we abandon the one-size-fits-all approach. However, another new era of vaccine development was predicted a long time ago. The first mention of vaccine riches, ironically, came from the pen of the World Health Organization in a 1998 newsletter that startled me in its outright admissions. It said that new microbes inflict new syndromes in different populations. And while it is bad for those people, it's good news for the Global Program for Vaccines and Immunization Employees. And that business is good and that their jobs will not likely disappear. Did you know that the World Health Organization is a business? Add to that the more recent published medical journal literature in Lancet and elsewhere showing that the World Health Organization does not often base its recommendations on evidence, and that there are huge conflicts of interest between their consultants and drug companies. For me, medicine was once a business too, and it was very good and lots of fun to have all that money in the years that I did. But the love of money can rip away at honesty, decency, and indeed life itself. In 1998, the World Health Organization published an update of their 1993 Children's Vaccine Initiative Plan. Here are some targets outlined in the book. Does this look to you like the mandates from an independent organization or a promoter of a business? Some people might say, well, so what? It's smart to have a business plan. But it's not what's in this book that's the main problem. The main problem is what's left out of this book. Where are the voices of the consumers whose kids became another statistic, or those who want facts to make a decision? The World Health Organization still isn't on top of the expanded program on immunization's unsafe syringe issues. For years, used vaccine syringes have mysteriously spread through the African black market. Other World Health Organization documents regarding unsafe injections state that these black market syringes have been responsible for widespread hepatitis B and HIV infections in undeveloped countries. Yet, the World Health Organization commit to twisting politicians' arms, parents' arms, co-opting mothers to advertise, and creating a climate of maximum vaccine acceptance and use, which by default makes criminals of all those who don't want to vaccinate their children. Today, in 2015, this looks like it's already happened. In 2015, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services pretty much took the 1997 World Health Organization book and mirrored that for adults. This is a plan that has been a long time in the making, and we're just getting to see the real nuts and bolts. Notice the goals here, also described as targets in the document. Today's climate is all about creating a culture of compliance. Anything outside that mandate isn't on the table for discussion. So what then happens to dissenters, public or medical? Doctors are humiliated, alienated, attacked, and called dangerous, incompetent quacks simply for criticizing mandatory vaccination, even when, like me, they were highly respected in their careers in conventional medicine. Doctors who see things that make them lose sleep rarely risk everything and speak. Some, like recent CDC whistleblower Dr. William Thompson, after decades of compliance with CDC insider policy, do speak. When Paul Offit was asked what he thought of this highly published veteran CDC scientist coming forward, his response was that Dr. Thompson must have psychological problems. Apparently, anyone who states anything potentially damning about vaccines, whether well-founded or not, is crazy, fraudulent, or a quack. Whether or not they are neurosurgeons, radiologists, Rockefeller-trained immunologists, Harvard vaccinologists, or pediatricians with decades of experience. But you can see that it has long been government policy to stamp out any doubt about vaccine programs, whether well-founded or not. It was interesting that the CDC gave Dr. Thompson an award after he spoke out, and that he felt the need to say he was now focused on his job and family. It remains to be seen what, if anything, Dr. Thompson will do next, and whether the CDC is trying to buy his silence. That's how it works. They also tried to stop Dr. Bernice Eddy talking about SV40 by offering her a deal they thought she would not refuse, but that didn't work. Their actions against Dr. Morris backfired because his morals would not tolerate open fraud, and neither would he be silenced. Doctors like me were never taught that decades of testing, which showed the flu vaccine was rubbish, never saw the light of day. Today, the Cochrane writings on the ineffectiveness of the flu vaccine and Dr. Tom Jefferson's view that the flu vaccine is given as policy, not for scientific reasons, is little known. The information in Sir Graham Wilson's book never made it to medical libraries or medical doctors' consciousness. Not too many people realize that at its core, the World Health Organization is a business. Most doctors wouldn't see a vaccine reaction if it bit them in the nose. And if they see one, most just stick their heads in the sand. This is why families in America get such a rough deal and why there are so many sick kids. I am only one of 7,000-plus nephrologists in the United States. I don't believe I'm the only person who has seen numerous patients suffer after vaccines. I think I'm just one doctor who listened to what patients were saying and did my own in-depth research. Speaking out as a doctor today means you risk your medical license, your income, and your reputation. So it's logical that most doctors will not touch the issue of vaccination, even if they do see something wrong. If Dr. Eddy was shut down even when her published work showed that injecting polio vaccines into hamsters caused tumors from polyomaviruses, and polio vaccines into monkeys caused paralysis because the vaccine virus that was supposed to be dead was still alive, and if Dr. Morris, with all the evidence he had, was treated the way he was, who in my hospital administration would care what a clinical nephrologist has to say? The bottom line is that clinicians should never be responsible for proving either drug or vaccine safety, as I was asked to do. A clinician's job is their patients. I didn't want to do a study to prove what I saw with my own eyes under the stressful, oppressive conditions I was surrounded with. My time is now better spent voicing scientifically valid concerns regarding vaccine safety. The question is, what will it take for scientific integrity to become valued in medicine? When will medical doctors realize that they're mostly just high-paid, drug-dispensing technicians for a dangerous religion that depends on everyone being ignorant about information relevant to vaccines? As a nephrologist, I was belittled for daring to join a few dots for the benefit of my patients and had to go searching for this kind of information. Back in 2009, I didn't understand why the hospital administration was battling me when all I asked was to defer vaccination until the day of discharge. It wasn't until this year when a nurse in high-level administration told me the hospitals are not reimbursed for the entire admission if patients are not vaccinated in the first 24 hours or if there is not a detailed explanation as to why they were not vaccinated. When parents call me today and tell me they were treated harshly and thrown out of their doctor's office for refusing to allow up to 8 vaccines and numerous injections into their infants in one day, I usually ask them why they even go there in the first place. Why expose children to stress, to disease in the office, to medicine by numbers, algorithms, to one-size-fits-all protocols delivered with a haughty disdain for choice, just to be told how their child is growing compared to the norm, and to be harassed into vaccinating? Most parents have no idea that between 25 and 80% of cases in measles outbreaks can come from medical centers. Most parents don't know that well child visits are linked to more than 700,000 subsequent flu-like illnesses, as per a 2014 report by Simmering. I suggest that parents find a health professional who can think laterally, independently, has many skills to offer, and who believes that parents bring something important to the table. The way things are going today with mandatory vaccines for everyone from cradle to grave, those doctors are going to be very busy. A 2000 report by the late Dr. Starfield revealed that every year, hospitals in the United States kill 225,000 people. Compare that to the average number of people who died from measles in the years before the measles vaccines. That number was 440. We're supposed to believe that all ended well with measles vaccines, so everyone today should just get vaccinated. We're not supposed to speak about the reality that what measles vaccines really did was take measles from the young children who handle it easiest and left the older kids, adults, and infants susceptible today, whereas those groups were protected in the pre-vaccine era. You're not supposed to know about primary or secondary vaccine failure. But the fact is that there are more susceptible people out there today because of the vaccine than there are because of vaccine refusal. And you're definitely not supposed to know that in 1963, the plan was to have measles eradicated by 1967, with a fantastic one-dose regimen given to just part of the childhood population. The fact is that the early measles vaccinologists had no idea that the measles vaccine would be so ineffective and its protection so short-lived because they hypothesized that just one shot would confer lifelong immunity, just like the natural virus does. Well, they were dead wrong. But getting back to the real risks today, shouldn't Paul Offit, Arthur Kaplan, Dart Rice, and Jimmy Kimmel all be screaming about the danger of hospitals and rushing to save the victims of inpatient and outpatient treatment? Apparently, when the medical system kills or maims a person, it is accepted, expected, forgivable, and forgettable. Why am I doing what I do today? Because I saw something very wrong going on, and nobody would listen to scientific reason. Even if vaccines can protect for some diseases for a period of time in a lifespan, which is the best they really can claim, the assurances given to both sick and well people regarding safety and effectiveness is not backed by science, history, or even a significant portion of the scientific and immunologic literature. We have peer-reviewed writing that details the historical tragedies with vaccination campaigns. We have case reports of unexpected vaccine injury, and we know some of the mechanisms of vaccine injury. We have a list of highly educated whistleblowers who were harassed and silenced by government agencies for trying to protect the public from drugs and vaccines they knew were unsafe. We have prominent pro-vaccine vaccinologists today stating that pertussis, flu, and measles vaccines are failing, and that the problem is not just vaccine refusal, but those scientists' statements are ignored. My position is that vaccines are not guaranteed to be safe, that ongoing production problems do exist, that potentially dangerous foreign animal DNA and chemicals are in the vaccines, which don't reliably protect. The public is given a false sense of security over the safety and efficacy of vaccination, mostly because the study that would put this debate to rest has never been done. A fully vaccinated versus never vaccinated study on existing populations would be very informative. But there's no funding to do it on a large scale, even though enough children who were never vaccinated do exist. If the government and pharmaceutical companies are confident in vaccines, then why not just do it? There's no literature on the safety of vaccinating the kinds of sick people that I tried to protect. There is evidence that viruses from the 1950s were introduced into the human population via vaccination. Those viruses can and do cause cancer and are related to other medical problems as well. The attempts of scientists to look in depth at these issues have been sabotaged and discouraged. Today, we continue to have vaccines contaminated with animal viruses, such as porcine circovirus in rotavirus vaccines that third parties discovered and not the vaccine manufacturers. The problems are not just with vaccines, but as I later realized, are pervasive through a medical profession that is addicted to drug prescribing. Some of what conventional medicine offers is valuable and life-saving, but much of it isn't. Doctors and patients have a right to know all options available to them and what the risks are of any drug or vaccine. If conventional medical doctors are ever able to see the harm that their profession inflicts upon humanity, and if they are willing to take the risk of looking outside the walls of the ivory tower and look first at nutrition, the microbiome, and supporting the immune system as the true foundation of health and the prevention of most illness, they might have something worthwhile to offer. Every day, vaccine reactions happen, yet doctors won't report them and deny they exist. The very people who should speak the truth stay silent to protect their wallets, reputations, and practices. Their dishonesty betrays those they are supposed to protect. Vaccine-damaged families are treated so badly, and exemptions are under threat because policy matters more than honesty. What do you consider quackery? Upholding policy or being honest?
Now let's hear from Dr. Nancy Banks.
I've looked very carefully at vaccines because my background is as an obstetrician and gynecologist. And one of the things that women certainly are going to be concerned about is whether or not they should give their children vaccines and how safe are the vaccines. And so part of my job was really looking at the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. And unfortunately, what I found that the CDC and the FDA were telling people and the truth of the vaccines were two different things. When I started in medicine, the rate of autism among children in the United States was about 1 in 10,000. And now the rate of autism is 1 in 100. Now, there is no way that could be a genetic problem. So it has to be an environmental problem. So the issue is, what has happened over the last 25 to 30 years to cause this epidemic of autism? And so the only thing that really has changed is the number of vaccines that are being recommended and are being given to children. So the issue is, what exactly is in those vaccines? Well, if you look at the ingredients of the vaccines, you will find that they have mercury and they have aluminum, and the vaccines are polluted with other kinds of viruses, and the vaccines are grown sometimes on human tissue. So these are vaccines that have elements that are neurotoxic, and then of course they have other elements that can set up autoimmune reactions. And so those are the kinds of things that we are seeing in the children. We are seeing autoimmune reactions We are seeing an autoimmune reaction against the brain tissue. And so these children, unfortunately, even the ones who are not developing the syndrome of autism, are developing other syndromes such as ADD and ADHD. And, of course, the secondary problem is the number of allergies that we're seeing in our young children. And part of the allergic reaction has to do with the fact that the immune system is not completely developed at birth. It takes about 3 years for the immune system to be developed. And so if you begin to give children vaccines, you actually set their immune system toward one part of the immune system called the humoral part, which makes more antibodies, yet at the same time you're suppressing their cellular immunity, which never develops completely. So the idea that we need to give children the number of vaccines that we're giving is simply a false notion. So the question I think that we have to ask ourselves, well, why is this being done? Well, for me, there are several reasons. One, it has to do with the pharmaceutical industry and the profitability of the pharmaceutical industry, because you have a whole population of children who become captive to the pharmaceutical industry. So that's number one. Number two, there was a book written several years ago by Lily Kay called The Molecular Basis of Biology. And Lily Kay was a medical historian out of Yale, very well respected. And she looked at the medical industry and how it was developed and the philosophy that was being pursued through biology. And of course, what she understood was that the entire medical paradigm was developed, the Western allopathic paradigm was developed by people who were essentially believed in eugenics. The other issue with vaccines is this. There really is no firm evidence that vaccines do what they say they do. They say that the introduction of vaccines actually reduce the amount of infectious diseases. But if you go back to the beginning of the century, you will really see that the thing that was reducing infectious diseases was an improvement in diet, an improvement in sanitation, an improvement in education. And so the societal things, the environmental things that were improving as a result of improving economies, and that economies and that people in those economies were doing better economically, you see that the number of infectious diseases were going down. I think that the idea that we can put toxins and poisons into a perfectly healthy immune system, a bloodstream, and not expect to get complications is naive at best, and more so, it's probably quite evil. When you're going to medical school, you actually think that you're studying science, but you're studying the science that someone has decided that is appropriate for you. And the science that they consider not appropriate for you, you don't study. For example, at the beginning of the century, the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations took over the discipline of allopathic medicine. How did they do that? They did it through their foundations, and they were able to finance those schools and those people that would actually promote the ideas, the eugenic ideas. So most of the students who come out of medical school are not going to question that. They are simply going to say, this is what I learned, and so this is how I'm going to proceed. It must be true. And they will go to the CDC or the FDA website, and that website will repeat the things that they heard in medical school. And one of the things that I found is that most of these doctors do not go to the original literature. They don't read the literature that would really question whether or not these vaccines are safe. And there's an enormous amount of propaganda, for example, from the pharmaceutical industries. So the pharmaceutical industries have enormous amounts of money to promote their particular products, whereas the people who are promoting health benefits of a more normal or natural type have almost no money. So this is one of the problems. So now you have a group of people who've spent 4 years under these conditions who come out of medical school, and now they're expected to be the authority, and their patients think that they are the authority, except the authority that they have is the authority that they've been given. It's almost papal in nature. And so that is basically how we get to the point where we are today. For example, you may not be able to do it in a first world country, but say you go to another country in Africa or Southeast Asia. You say, okay, this group of children has not been vaccinated. This group of children is vaccinated. What is going to be the outcome in these two children in terms of developing measles or smallpox or whatever? So that would be how you do it. But these studies have never been done, and I don't think these studies are ever going to be done. And unfortunately, the drug companies have too much invested in the whole vaccine paradigm right now. And the other big problem at this point is there are so many children that have been harmed that to back away from this paradigm at this time would be a disaster financially for these people, because somebody is going to have to account for the number of children who've been damaged. When we study cell biology, we study proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, but 80 to 90% of our body is water, and so we don't even study water. So for me, it was my own illness that really made me begin to look at the entire paradigm of allopathic medicine. And so once I did that, again, because I'm an obstetrician-gynecologist, I started looking at the vaccines that we were recommending, because at that point, many women began to say, I don't think I want to give my children these vaccines because I've heard that the vaccines cause autism. And I wasn't sure about it myself. And so that's when I really began to look at the vaccines and I began to look at the data. Well, the data was really quite alarming to me. And I felt that I needed to be able to give my patients options. I was giving my total commitment to vaccines before, and as I began to look at the data, I had to back away from it. But most doctors, unless you have a crisis in your life or you have a crisis with a patient, I think most doctors really don't examine what they're doing. I think they do what they do because they've been trained. They haven't been educated. And that is the problem with our entire so-called education system. We're not educating people to think. We're training people to do a job. Well, one of the things that I've come to realize is that we're not doing science. We're doing warfare. And warfare works on many levels. People tend to think of warfare as guns and cannons, but warfare starts out on a psychological level. And so what happens to people who step outside of the medical paradigm and start to really want to do healing? It can be quite dangerous. If you're an academician and you have status in the university, you can lose your funding, you can lose your graduate students. If you're a clinician in the community, you can have the medical society come after you. If you have a position on a university hospital or a staff, you can sometimes lose your position on the staff because the other physicians are there to make sure that you practice what they call the standard of care. So the standard of care may not have anything to do with the best care or what is scientifically valid. It has to do with what everybody else is doing. And what is so interesting about this is that I was reading about the Inquisition. Now, the Inquisition was a period in European history that lasted for about 300 years. And one of the fascinating things for me is that at least 9 million people were killed during this time for going against the teachings of the church. And most of those people who were killed were women. Many of them were midwives and herbalists, because the church believed that if you were sick, it was a sin, and therefore you needed to suffer. And of course, these women were about reducing suffering and healing people and making people feel better. And so there were 300 years of persecution of women who were healers. And today, we certainly don't have an inquisition in terms of the church, but we still have an idea that medicine can only be done in one way. And if we don't do it that way, then we have the inquisition. We have the inquisition of the pharmaceutical industry. We have the inquisition of the AMA. We have the inquisition of the local medical societies who actually will come after physicians and try to destroy their practices or their careers. I think people need to know that vaccines are dangerous, that the idea that there's no risk to a vaccine, there's no risk currently or in the future is an idiotic notion. I think we have enough data at this point to know that vaccines can cause damage immediately or in the future, and that we need to be able to give our parents enough information to make informed choices. And I think that we need to actually stop with the vaccines at this point. Recently, the Merck and one other pharmaceutical company have been promoting a vaccine against cervical cancer. First of all, there's no proof that HPV causes cervical cancer. Association is not causation. There's no proof that this vaccine works. The vaccine was only tested for 4 years before they put it on the market. Of course, cervical cancer does not show up in women until they're in their 40s, 50s, or 60s. So how is it you're going to give a 13-year-old, a 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old girl this vaccine and think that it's going to prevent something that happens to her 50 years later? And we've had a number of deaths with this vaccine. We've had some children who are developing long-term medical conditions, which we have no idea whether they're going to reverse. And so we're giving a vaccine which is totally useless, which has no proof that it has any efficacy, and has solid proof that it is harmful, and yet people are sacrificing their young daughters to the vaccine gods. I find that, you know, right now I'm living in Mexico, and in Mexico, they say the Aztecs used to sacrifice people to the gods. And so I think here in North America, we are sacrificing our children to the vaccine gods, and I'd like to see a change because I think it's quite primitive.
Now let us hear from a group of parents who were all pro-vaccine. In fact, they vaccinated their children, as you will hear, but they oppose California Senate Bill 277.
If there's risk, there must be choice. If there's risk, there must be choice. If there's risk, there must be choice.
SB 277 is a mandatory vaccination bill that would strip the parental right of parents in the state of California to choose and to have informed consent over a medical procedure for their child, which vaccination is a medical procedure. And it is, if we don't choose to follow the CDC recommended schedule, which has almost tripled in the last 15 years, then our children are losing the right to not only a public education, but a private education in the state of California.
We're basically kicking out kids that are not sick, they're not contagious, on the supposition that they may in the future get a rare disease, and they might be sent to school with that disease, and they might get someone sick. So we're kicking children out based on that premise. There have only been 100 measles cases in the entire nation, basically, and there's 320 million people in the U.S. So that is not compelling interest when no one has died from the measles.
Initially on the bill, homeschooling was included in that bill as under the umbrella of SB 277. They have since amended it to exclude homeschooling, so parents do have an option. But for many families in the state of California, homeschooling is not an option.
A parent cannot afford to quit their job, so they are basically going to be forced to vaccinate their children, even if they've demonstrated a susceptibility to vulnerability to the vaccine.
A vaccine decision should be something that happens between a doctor and a parent, and you want to work with your doctor to make those decisions that you're comfortable with. You know, I need to vaccinate my children or else they don't get a proper education, which is their right. It's a constitutional right.
act. It's unconstitutional. It violates the Nuremberg Code. It violates education rights. It violates parental consent. It violates the relationship between a doctor and a patient.
I feel like it's discrimination. The California Constitution guarantees a right, an equal right, to an education to each and every child in the state of California, regardless of their race, even kids with HIV, hepatitis B, and tuberculosis are protected under the California Constitution and are not supposed to be discriminated against based on a fear of contagion.
There's been a lot of adverse reactions, and I know a lot of people say, no, there's no link to autism and vaccines. But when you actually talk to parents whose children have been through it and they've been vaccinated and they've had these adverse reactions, those are the type of people that I'm going to believe.
My oldest got the chickenpox vaccine and got shingles in her eye following that. I have my middle child who wheezed after his two-month shot and was diagnosed with full-blown asthma by 18 months. And my third child received a vaccination and went into anaphylactic shock following the DTaP shot. So basically they're all on personal belief exemptions because it's just not enough for them to get medical exemptions. My youngest can qualify for a medical exemption for the anaphylactic shock on the one vaccine. However, there are numerous other vaccines, 15 other vaccines that he would be required to get. My concern is that they have the same ingredients in them that he reacted to. I have no way of identifying which ingredient which put him into anaphylactic shock.
We had started vaccination with both of my daughters. They both had strong reactions to the shots that they did receive. My husband is a paramedic. We're well-educated people. We both have college degrees. And we individually and collectively came to the understanding that the vaccinations that are currently on the market are not safe for our kids.
We had two children in Mexico die that were undergoing the national vaccination program. There are six others in grave condition and 30 total that were hospitalized. And the country of Mexico has suspended the vaccination program based on this occurrence. And we have the same thing, we've seen Japan. They do not vaccinate children unless they're 2 years old or older because of the risk of death. We have 16,000 kids a year in the U.S. dying from SIDS. We don't have an explanation as to why they're dying.
Vaccines are individually tested, and I would argue they're fraudulently individually tested. However, that's my opinion on the matter. But the actual schedule, the 49 shots by the age of six, has never been tested to show that it's safe, to show that that amount of carcinogenic chemicals going into the bloodstream of a developing immune system is valuable for a child. And we have an increase in almost every neurological disease in children. One in five kids have a mental disorder. Autism's on the rise. It's one in 68 children. So it's taking away parental rights. It's taking away informed medical consent. It's making the state responsible for your child's body rather than each individual parent doing their own informed, due diligent research about vaccinations. And it's robbing a child of a public and private education. So I would encourage every parent, if you don't really know what's going on and you're wondering, what are we all talking about? I would encourage you to do your own research. Look into the vaccination issue. Go on the CDC website and pull up the ingredient list in every single shot and consciously look at that and go, am I comfortable with those ingredients being injected into my child's bloodstream? And weigh the risk and benefit, because that's what all of us have done. And we've spent hours and hours and hours of our personal time, our energy, our money, our resources, researching, educating people about this issue. So it comes down to a choice, and SB 277 would rob parents of that choice.
I encourage you to get involved in this issue. This is a very slippery slope that you do not want to go down. If we allow the state to have the right over the sovereignty of our own bodies, where will it stop? Are they going to force us to take chemotherapy? Are they going to force us to take antibiotics for everything? We know that every single drug has risk. If you'd like to get involved and find out how to stop mandatory vaccination, please visit stopmandatoryvaccination.com and click on the Take Action tab to find a group near you where you can become involved.
Stop mandatory vaccinations!
Let us now hear from Dr. Stephanie Senef, a PhD from MIT. One of the more interesting discussions between vaccines, glyphosate, the herbicide, also better known as Roundup, and autism.
Another component of autism, at least that it's an argument anyway, is vaccines. kids these days are getting multiple times more than, you know, when I was a child. Is this making us healthier, more protected, or what is it actually doing with
these doses? I really think we've way overdone it on the vaccines. It's funny how we managed to program people to believe so thoroughly that vaccines are awesome, you know. Mm-hmm. This was all set up with the polio and the smallpox, you know. We said, oh, yes, of course, vaccines are wonderful. When can I get a vaccine for this? You know, give me a vaccine that will fix this problem. We've got that entire mentality, which is amazing to me because the vaccines are full of toxic chemicals. And certainly I looked at the vaccines first, and I have there's a great database, the VARS database, Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System. Very, very interesting. And I've looked at it. I mean, I'm a computer scientist, so I can go, you know, look at the number crunching, looking at the words and what statistical distributions and whatnot. You can find a lot of things out from looking at VARS. And one thing really striking is MMR. MMR is the vaccine measles, mumps, and rubella. And Andrew Wakefield connected that to autism way back when, like 1998, I guess. He had this paper in Lancet, which was very interesting. And he had taken these certain cases of kids with autism, connected it to the MMR vaccine. And he had a whole theory. In fact, he was into the idea of the gut, the gut-brain axis connection and disruption of the gut even back then. So this is something that's been around as a theory for autism for a long time. And he targeted MMR, but he didn't really explain what is it in MMR that's causing this. And I was frustrated by that as well. I confirmed in my studies of the VARS database that MMR is associated with autism. And I wrote a paper on that, and I proposed at the time that possibly, and it was something somebody else had also proposed, which was that the acetaminophen that is given, which is to control the fever,
sure.
Kids are often given that around the vaccine, and that can become toxic to certain kids who can't metabolize it properly. Well, so it turns out, only recently did I figure out the connection to glutamate with MMR. It's truly amazing, because MMR is one of the few vaccines that contain glutamate. And, of course, glutamate is toxic to autistic kids because they don't have manganese. That's my theory, anyway. And so when you've got that extra glutamate directly injected in through the vaccine, it goes to the brain because of the influence of the glyphosate. The glyphosate actually opens up barriers. It opens up the gut barrier and it opens up the brain barrier, which allows these things to get in. So then what I've done only recently, and I haven't published this yet, but I looked at MMR before and after 2002. You can take like a group, all the vaccines before, all the vaccines after, same vaccine, and just look at the reports of the adverse reactions, look statistically at the numbers to see which ones are occurring out differently. They ought to all be the same because it's the same vaccine,
sure.
But they're not. And so it's very, very interesting because the vaccines, the events that occur, the reactions that occur after 2002, one of them is autism. It predicts autism statistically significantly when you compare after 2002 with before 2002. What this is saying is that now it's causal in autism, but then it wasn't in some sense. You know, or it's more causal in autism now than it was then. And it also predicts all these things having to do with the brain. You know, there's seizures and there's sort of shortness of breath and swelling of the face. I mean, all these things. So, you know, brain swelling is one of the things that's connected to autism. And so so it's really strange that it's different before and after. And the reason for it, I think, is the glyphosate, so that the two are working synergistically together to cause harm because the glyphosate is depleting the manganese, which is causing the glutamate to be toxic, and the glyphosate is causing the glutamate to go into the brain. Before 2002, there's only one thing that's more prevalent before 2002, which is joint pain. So joint pain says it's not going to the brain, it's going to the joints, you know? So this and all of those things that are different between before and after are known to be reactions to glutamate for people who have a sensitivity to glutamate. So it totally makes sense that it's the glutamate in the vaccine that's causing the problem and that the glutamate is much more toxic now because of the glyphosate. So all this is connecting up. And the same thing is true for the aluminum in the vaccines as well. And people have talked a lot about the mercury, and the mercury certainly is an issue and it's very toxic. I looked at the aluminum because that's the one that's gone up quite a bit. We have a lot of aluminum-containing vaccines now that we didn't have before. So that one fits with the what's going up in step with the autism increase. Lots more aluminum-containing vaccines. I mean, for example, even the HPV, which has just been introduced, Gardasil, they're giving that to these kids, teenagers. That's loaded with aluminum. And that's a very nasty vaccine. I've looked at that one, too, and it has much, much more severe reactions to that one than to other vaccines that these kids are getting. So it's a very toxic vaccine. And totally unnecessary, in my opinion. And probably they can't even prove that it's actually doing what it's claiming to do, because it's like 60 years later when you're going to get this cervical cancer that it's supposedly protecting you from, you know? I don't know why anybody would think it was a good idea to get that vaccine. And young girls' lives are being destroyed. People are, they're dying, or they're getting some debilitating autoimmune disease, you know, from that vaccine. It's very clear from the data. So, yeah, I think the problem is there's synergy between the vaccine and the glyphosate. And I've looked at aluminum and glyphosate. Very, very interesting, because there's papers that show the glyphosate chelates aluminum just like it does all these other minerals. It ends up hiding the aluminum inside the glyphosate molecules, which gets rid of the plus three charge. Aluminum has a very strong positive charge, which ordinarily would keep it in the gut, so it wouldn't get past the gut barrier. But with the cage around it, it becomes a neutral molecule. And furthermore, glyphosate has an effect like citrate that opens up the gut barrier. And that same effect will open up the brain barrier as well. So that the glyphosate is letting the aluminum pass the gates from the gut into the blood, from the blood into the brain. And the glyphosate is also bringing the aluminum to the pineal gland, which is outside of the blood-brain barrier. So that pineal gland is much more susceptible. People have studied the amount of aluminum in various parts of the brain. They find the pineal gland has twice as much as the other parts because of it being outside of the blood-brain barrier. So, but with the glyphosate, you get an increased delivery of the aluminum to the pineal gland, which ends up messing it up. And so I've noted that there's sleep disorder associated with so many of these neurological diseases. I mean, autism, Alzheimer's, dementia, depression, Parkinson's disease, multiple sclerosis, all of these things are associated with sleep disorder. Pineal gland produces the melatonin that controls the wake-sleep cycle. So when the pineal gland gets messed up, you can't make enough melatonin, you can't sleep, and that's connected then to everything else. Furthermore, melatonin is a product of the shikimate pathway, which is the exact pathway that glyphosate disrupts. And I haven't gotten into that before here in this interview, but this is what Monsanto says. Oh, yeah, shikimate pathway. We don't have that pathway in our cells, so ha-ha-ha, glyphosate's harmless to us. But the problem is that our gut bacteria do have that pathway. They use it to make these essential amino acids that we can't make. And we can't make them because we don't have that pathway. We depend on our gut bacteria to provide those for us. If they're exposed to glyphosate, they can't make it. And tryptophan is one of those really important molecules that's a precursor to melatonin and to serotonin and to melanin, which is what gets your skin dark when you're exposed to sunlight. So all of those are going to be deficient if you don't have enough tryptophan. And I think that's another key piece of the puzzle.
Let us hear a commentary on, do vaccines cause autism?
Do vaccines cause autism? In the last 30 years, the childhood vaccine schedule has tripled, while the U.S. autism rate has skyrocketed from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 50. Dozens of published research papers show that, yes, vaccines and autism are linked. Yet the debate rages on, in part because of the 1986 National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, passed by Congress as a result of pharmaceutical lobbying. It shields drug companies from liability for injuries and deaths caused by the vaccines they manufacture. Vaccines that the federal government admits are unavoidably unsafe. To see how this tilted the law in Big Pharma's favor, let's look at Eric, a child suffering from vaccine-induced autism. Had Eric been harmed by a pharmaceutical product other than vaccines, his parents could sue the manufacturer in civil court, entitling them to the standard legal process with a judge, jury, private attorneys, legal precedent, and discovery, all within public view. But for kids like Eric, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act says no. Instead of suing the pharmaceutical company directly, parents of children like Eric are forced to petition the Department of Health and Human Services, and if federal health officials oppose compensation, the case is argued before a special master in the U.S. Claims Court. Many refer to this as vaccine court, though it isn't a court at all, but rather an administrative procedure in which the family asks the government to admit the vaccine caused their child harm and requests compensation for the child's care. Here are some shocking facts about the so-called vaccine court. Pharmaceutical companies do not have to participate in the proceedings at all. Taxpayers pay for all damages. The U.S. Department of Justice acts as the government's lawyer, with taxpayers footing the bill for their defense. The family's attorney is paid out of the trust fund, administered by the Department of Health and Human Services, which has a history of punishing plaintiffs' lawyers by slashing their fees and waiting a decade or more to pay them, leaving some families without any legal representation. There's no required discovery process, so potentially incriminating documents stay hidden in the hands of the vaccine manufacturers. Most hearings are off-limits. No public, no reporters. There's no judge or jury. A special master appointed by the U.S. Court of Federal Claims both presides over the hearings and issues the rulings, which can limit the chance of an objective verdict. Legal precedent is limited, so the program issues contradictory rulings. In the case of Bailey Banks, a special master ruled the boy's autism was caused in fact by the MMR vaccine. Yet in later cases, special masters ruled that vaccines do not cause autism, even though federal compensation has been awarded in at least 83 cases with autism. Almost unbelievably, the Department of Health and Human Services actually owns vaccine patents. When these vaccines are purchased, HHS profits. In the words of Eric's mom, government attorneys defend a government program using government-funded science decided by federal bureaucrats trying to keep their government jobs. Kids like Eric never had a chance. The passing of the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act prompted manufacturers to ramp up development of new vaccines, furiously lobbying the CDC to add their new shots to the recommended schedule. As a result, a baby today receives more vaccinations by 6 months than her mother did by the time she graduated high school. Amazingly, neither HHS nor Congress has ever reviewed the potentially devastating health effects this vaccination surge has had on our children. Today, over half of all U.S. kids suffer from chronic disease and disability. At a November 2012 congressional autism hearing, CDC officials failed to cite even one study backing up vaccine safety claims. Congress is now planning federal hearings to further investigate the vaccine injury compensation program. The next round of hearings begins in November of 2013. If you're outraged by the staggering miscarriage of justice exposed in this video, please visit canaryparty.org now and register for our mailing list. Find out how you can help hold our government accountable for vaccine safety and bring about justice for our vaccine-injured children. I'm Rob Schneider. Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from a medical doctor, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, about the truth about Gardasil.
Good morning, and welcome to this live presentation called Saying No to Vaccines. And this is the presentation that you're going to find out why this is an important thing for you to do. Now, let's start with a little bit of things that have been going on in the news. And this is just in the last year. In February of 2007, Governor Perry in Texas mandated the HPV or Gardasil vaccine for 9-year-old girls by executive order. He bypassed the legislature. He bypassed all of the disruptions and all the things that the activists did not want to have them do. And he signed it into law by executive order. And during that same period of time in 2007, there were legislators in at least 33 additional states, including Washington, D.C., that introduced legislation to require, fund, or educate the public about the HPV vaccine that is designed to prevent cervical cancer. But we're going to talk about that a little bit later to see that there are things that you need to know about that vaccine that it may not be nearly as preventive as what they're promoting. In November of 2007, there was a big thing that was on the news about Baltimore, Maryland, where there were many children who were kept out of school for up to 60 days because they did not have a completed vaccination record. The parents were told no vaccines, no school, and if you don't get your kids vaccinated, they were threatened with jail time. There were more than 1,200 parents that were brought before a judge, and many of the kids already had their vaccination records. The school had simply lost them. In December of 2007, New Jersey became the first state to require influenza shots in order to attend kindergarten. There's a very large outcry about this going on in New Jersey. There's a lot of people trying to implement the mandatory vaccination, get it off the schedule, and to also put into place a philosophical exemption for the state, which New Jersey doesn't have at this time. And as time goes on, we're going to be seeing more and more of these types of actions. There's been presentations in the through the Department of Public Health and through the Centers for Disease Control that talks about we want to remove all rights to refuse vaccines and to take away religious exemptions, philosophical exemptions, and in some cases even medical exemptions, which takes away your freedoms, your health freedom, and your right to refuse what gets injected into your body. So where is this going to stop? It's gone on from year after year after year. It's going to be more and more vaccines. We're going to talk later on in the presentation about how many vaccines are currently in the vaccination schedule. And where is this going to stop? How many vaccines are going to be deposited into children and adults? And how many times are you going to have the right to refuse? Or is that going to be taken away? Well, I'm a really big believer that if you don't learn the lessons from history, you're bound to repeat them. So where did this start from? How did we get to the place where we have mandatory vaccination in exchange for a publicly funded, tax-paid, prepaid tax education for our children? So by the time your child is born, you're paying property taxes. That goes into a fund to start prepaying your children being able to go to school. But yet, when it's time for them to go to school, you're saying the only way that they're allowed through the door is that they are given this list of vaccinations that have been arbitrarily prescribed to the school system. Two books that I really recommend anybody who's interested in the topic of vaccination to get, because it gives such an incredible background and tells us how we got to this place. One is called Bodily Matters, which is the anti-vaccination movement in England, published by Duke University Press and written by Dr. Nanja Durbach. She is a professor of history at Brigham Young University, and this was part of her original thesis that then she subsequently turned into a book. It is an incredible book with the most incredible background information and documentation that you just won't find anywhere else about the vaccination movement. Well, she goes up until 1907 and talks an awful lot about what's happening in the UK and what rolled over from the United Kingdom in about that same period of time was a law that was passed by the US Supreme Court referred to as Jacobson versus Massachusetts. And that was put into place in 1904 in this country, which then began requiring mandatory vaccination for schools. So much of what happened in the UK and their legislature and their laws was brought forth into our country during that period of time. That is where Mr. James Colgrove's book picks up with The State of Immunity, Politics of Vaccination in the 21st Century of America. He sort of picks up where Dr. Durbach left off in terms of starting with the Jacobson versus Massachusetts law in the early 1900s and goes up to the 1960s and 1970s and lays the backdrop of all the different vaccines that came into play and the whole development of the public health department in this country. Both of these books are incredible documents for anybody that's interested in this type of discussion about vaccines and mandatory vaccinations. I highly recommend both of them to be part of your library. Well, many of us know the history of vaccination, but we're just going to talk about this a little bit. In my book, Saying No to Vaccines, a resource guide, there goes into a lot of detail about this mandatory vaccination in the backdrop. But just for the sake of this presentation, we'll cover it just briefly. In the 1790s, Edward Jenner invented vaccination, and he did it by observing that milkmaids regular contact with cowpox, which was a common virus that was seen in the cattle industry, that those people who were exposed to those types of mild viruses rarely got severe cases of smallpox. So what he did was he inoculated the cowpox into a young boy, was subsequently exposed to the smallpox virus, and it found out that the young boy did not contract a full-blown case of smallpox. Hence, an entire vaccination industry was developed and born. And it was based entirely on empirical evidence and observation. There was no understanding of immunity or how it worked or why it worked. That was centuries away. In fact, right now, in this day and age of In 2008, we are just beginning to understand the ramifications of this. There's no understanding of the impact of vaccines can have on the immune system, what sort of detrimental effects, what sort of side effects, what sort of health consequences can happen with all these vaccines and viruses being injected into your body. We're just now beginning to understand this. So this has been going on since the early 1800s. In fact, the first smallpox vaccine in the United States was in 1802 in South Carolina. So we've been doing this for a very long time without having any understanding of what the impacts are on our bodies. In 1850, the Epidemiological Society of London was found, and they began to look at statistics as a way to promote a reason for doing things, that statistics, numbers gave the appearance of objectivity and scientific weight to otherwise subjective opinions. So instead of me just saying, it's my opinion or my observation that vaccination worked, we needed to see whether it worked or not. So statistics began to be collected to promote the use of vaccination. A task was given to the Epidemiological Society to prove the premise that more people died from smallpox if they were unvaccinated, which is, anybody who has any background in science or research understands that this is sort of a faulty premise to start with. In research, you start with a premise, things like, does the smallpox vaccination do anything to keep people from succumbing to smallpox? And so you start with a different premise. What their premise was to prove that it worked. It's not a very good place to start with your scientific research. There was a lot of problems with these studies. Vaccinated versus unvaccinated status was determined solely by the presence of a vaccination scar. And vaccination back in the 1800s was a fairly aggressive procedure where they used to actually make slits in your arm with scalpels and then take the underbelly of the cow, the lymph from the cow, and actually slather it on your arm in order to inoculate you with the cowpox. So if you had a scar, you were considered to be vaccinated. The difference was that some of the people who did the vaccinations, the midwives and the apothecaries, which was the name for the pharmacists at that time, made very small, very delicate types of incisions. So you didn't necessarily see the scar on every single person. And because this was with the Victorian age, sometimes they placed it in places where you didn't really notice it because they didn't want the women's arms to be distorted. So the premise of looking for a scar in order to say whether or not you've been vaccinated, that was rather a faulty premise to start. Then that carried on forward to say that if a vaccinated person contracted the disease, the patient was considered to be unvaccinated. And if a vaccinated person died, he was considered to be improperly vaccinated and considered to be unvaccinated. So now you're already skewing the statistics of saying, even though they've been vaccinated, if something happened, we're going to put them in the category of the unvaccinated. Mild cases of smallpox, which is more than 90% of all cases of people who were exposed and experienced smallpox, and recovered uneventfully, were not included in the statistics at all. And the mortality rates were derived from extremely ill patients who died in hospitals, which created a sample bias. If people were sick enough to go into the hospital and then they died, compared to the thousands of people who were out in a community and had very little evidence of even having smallpox and was like having a mild flu or a mild case of chickenpox, that was very heavily weighting the statistics in favor of those who were very sick died. Well, there's a modern-day comparison of that, and it was something that was just in our news just a couple of years ago. Back in 2006, I'm sure that many of you remember all the things that were on the news about bird flu, and it was just prevalent, and every night we heard more and more statistics, and what we heard out of those statistics were the death rate from bird flu is about 50%, which, again, was making everybody be very fearful and wanting to develop a vaccine to prevent this. However, this was another case of skewed statistics, that thousands of individuals who were infected with the bird flu virus, the name of that virus was H5N1, did not become sick enough to even require medical care. And Mr. Dick Thompson, who was a spokesperson from the World Health Organization, said, quote, "The obvious assumption is that people are infected and either not getting sick or not getting sick enough to seek treatment in a hospital. Factoring those patients make the death rate impossible to determine because the denominator is unknown. If you have 150 people that are sick and died, but you had 2,000 people in the denominator, what is that actual death rate as opposed to 50 people that were in the 100 people in the hospital, 50% 50 people died?" That's a 50% death rate. If you had 2,000 people were sick with 50 people died, it makes it 0.000 something in terms of what the actual death rate is. So we were, again, even here in 2006, having an issue with skewed statistics. Another example was Dr. John Allen Paulus, professor of mathematics at Temple University, concurred with Thompson's observation, and Paulus asserted that this whole thing that was happening with bird flu was an almost textbook case of sample bias, because asymptomatic and those who had recovered uneventfully were not part of the mortality calculations. As a consequence, the numbers were skewed substantially upward. So this is something that has been going on for 150 years in order to promote vaccination, to instill fear in people of these diseases, and saying that if I get this disease, I'm going to die, and so therefore the only way to protect myself from dying is to get a vaccine. It's been used in the media for a very long time. For more information about all this, any of you can obtain a copy of my other book that I wrote and published in 2006 called Fowl, Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. There are chapters, very in-depth chapters in there about influenza vaccine, about what's coming through the needle, why you should think very long and hard before you would ever get a flu shot, cultured vaccines and different things that are part of the what else is in that needle, and mandatory vaccination, is it really a possibility? And that book can be easily obtained through our office or through the website, SayingNoToVaccines.com or DrTenpenny.com. And for more information about anything about the flu shot and about bird flu, this is the resource that you should get. So back to what we were talking about previously in terms of what was happening in terms of our history lesson in the UK, that despite problems with the vaccination statistics, the conclusion that came out of that research was more deaths occurred amongst the unvaccinated. Every unvaccinated person was considered to be a nidus for disease. They were just walking around populating and infecting everybody. No one should be able to jeopardize the lives of others by refusing to be vaccinated. And the society recommended only mandatory vaccination could ensure the health of the society. Children were at the center of all infections. Therefore, it was mandatory to vaccinate all infants from the time that they were 1 or 2 months of age. And penalties needed to be enforced for noncompliance. Can you see how some of these things are applying to today? The penalties being enforced for noncompliance, dragging parents into court systems to get their kids vaccinated, it's still going on 150 years later. So after these recommendations came out in the UK, a new law was passed, and that came out in 1853, which was the first compulsory vaccination act. The law required universal mandatory vaccination for all infants to protect children from their negligent parents, which was actually what was inside of the law. That was part of the language. Laws made vaccination a service provided by the state and allowed it to be regulated. Medical doctors began to demand that vaccination could only be administered by licensed medical practitioners, taking it out of the hands of the careful midwives and the careful apothecaries. Later, there was another act that was passed called the Compulsory Vaccination Act of 1867 that forced vaccination fines, property seizure, and imprisonment on parents who did not comply. Interestingly enough, during that time frame of the mid-1850s, there was no medical profession as we know it today. There were no doctors' training programs. Medical practitioners were classified as either physicians, servants, or apothecaries. So physicians administered medicines, surgeons obviously did surgery, and apothecaries were the ones who made the drugs. They were the pharmacists. There were 19 different licensing bodies that exist. You could get your degree just by purchasing it. You could get it at a university. You could get it by being an apprentice. There was no uniform regulations or criteria for treatments, and there was no standardized medical education. Vaccination was administered by all these different practitioners, and doctors didn't like it. They didn't like the fact that and so vaccination was wanting to be taken over by physicians, and the physicians who were in Parliament at that time started to make movements to get laws passed so it would go definitely into their hands. And after the passage of the 1853 Vaccination Act, doctors pushed for further regulation to eliminate all their competition. So therefore, it's my opinion that the foundation of modern orthodox medical practice evolved from controlling vaccines and vaccination because it was the first medical intervention enforced by British law and now by U.S. law. So as medicine as a profession was starting to gel, and we were starting to see that there needed to be standardized training, standardized education, the foundation of that came out of the whole vaccination industry. And as physicians became known as the vaccinators, they had different clinics that were set up for vaccination, the money trade and the money that started to come from that. So I believe that it's almost wrapped up in the DNA of the profession. It's like the very founding parts of the profession. And why now? If any parent or any other practitioner tries to question vaccines, or if parents go in and say, I don't want my children to have this, there's this vehement blowback by the doctors who administer them, because it's almost like challenging the very substance of medicine from which they came. And so it's so entwined into the fabric of medicine that it's very, very hard to unwind that. Resistance to mandatory vaccination started at about the same time. There was a lot of people that saw that this may not be in the best interest of children or in adults. Many of the people that died from secondary infections, from this cutting open of their arms. There were many people that died from gangrene. There were many people who lost limbs because of this vaccination. So there was a large resistance movement started about the same time. In 1853, the anti-vaccination movement was started. Was organized national movement of grassroots resistance referred to as Our Baby's Battle. The campaign to repeal compulsory vaccination involved local demonstrations, hiding children, acts of civil disobedience, and voluntary incarceration. And in Dr. Durbach's book, she tells a story about how they would sometimes cut holes in walls, and when the vaccinators would come to the door, they would pass the children through the wall to the next little apartment. And when the vaccinator would go next door, they would pass them back. There was one story that she told about a woman when the vaccinators came to the door, that she actually had a butcher knife and she chased the vaccinator down the street. That was probably me. I was probably the one who did that. It was my great-great aunt or something like that, because I can just see myself doing that. Get away from my babies. Widespread resistance led by individuals whose children had been injured or died from vaccination. And we see that now rising up in the autism community, of how many parents have seen their children on videotape go from being completely normal children on their one-year-old birthday. Within that week, they go and get their one-year-old big battery of shots that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. And then within a week or two, they can see them regress into the world of autism. No eye communication. They've lost their language. They have now drifted off into a world of their own. And those parents, those angry parents, are being blamed, that they need something to blame for this regression that has happened to their children. And what really, they are not just blaming vaccines. They have actually witnessed this happen to their children. And they are the resistance movement that's happening in this country today. Anti-vaccinationists were dismissed by local authorities as part of the anti-authority fringe, that we just didn't want to be told what to do. Resistance and mandatory vaccination continues today. In my opinion, it's the number one health freedom issue that we have, more than 150 years later. Making the decision of what gets injected into your body or into the body of your children should be your right, and not be mandated by public health authorities. In 1853, alternative medicine was also taking off as a challenge to what was happening with these vaccinations. The philosophy of alternative medicine included strong objections to vaccination, considered to be an experiment resulting in contamination of the blood with animal materials. Strong opposition to bloodletting and drugging promoted by orthodox medical practitioners. Belief in vaccination benefited only doctors, as it produced a sicklier population. Insistent that each person have the right to choose medical therapies agreeable to his personal views, and it proposed that health was about healing, not about drugging. Treatments needed to affect the whole body, not just an individual part. They wanted patients to participate in their healing and not just sit back and be told what to do. This is no different than the view of alternative or integrative medicine that we have today. We have strong objections to vaccination because it does contaminate the blood with animal materials. In fact, many of the vaccines are made from dog kidney cells and caterpillar cells and monkey kidney cells and a variety of other animal cells, including aborted fetal tissues. Many of the vaccines are made from there. We don't believe in drugging. We want people to get well through natural means. So this whole backdrop started 150 years ago. So if we're not learning the lessons of history, we are repeating them. So I love this quote, and consider that it comes from 1866, where it says, "Orthodox medicine is worse than the tax man. Not only does it take your money, it can be fatal." So we've been talking about this for a really long time. And the most recent discussion, most recent mandate that's come about, that we started at the top of the program talking about all of the states that are trying to pass this into law, has to do with a vaccine whose name is Gardasil. Gardasil is a vaccine for HPV. HPV is human papillomavirus, and for treatment of and prevention of cervical cancer. But what do we really know about this infection and about these viruses? And what do we know about this vaccine? Is this a good thing to be giving 9 and 10 and 11-year-old little girls? Is this a good thing to be giving 26-year-old women? Is there better ways and different things that we can do? Well, what is HPV and what does that stand for? Well, the initials HPV stand for human papillomavirus. The HPV infection of the cervix occurs mainly as a result of sexual intercourse. HPV infections are extremely common over a lifetime. In fact, researchers admit that there are almost no truly uninfected women. Sort of like getting a cold. Sort of like getting a cold or a flu. Almost everybody's had that at some point in time in their life, but it doesn't stay around forever. It sort of passes through, your body figures it out and moves on. Well, HPV infections of the cervix are similar. They come, they stay for a while. A very small percentage of those stay and create any problems. They just sort of come and go. So when the researchers were first doing the research and doing cervical cultures to try to determine, we needed to have people who had not been exposed to this virus to test the vaccine on, people already had antibodies to it because they had already had the infection. So almost every woman get this at some point in time, so it's not anything to be hysterical about. Risk factors for that virus progressing on and being associated with cancer include genetic susceptibility, smoking, parity, which is the number of children that you've had, the number of different sexual partners, co-infections of other type of bacterial infections in the vagina, and long-term use of birth control pills. Now, if those are the complicating factors, and we're seeing that in 9 and 10-year-old girls, I think that we have more problems with our society than HPV infections. We need to be talking about prevention and other types of lifestyle things rather than just injecting them with a vaccine that is probably not going to work. So what do we know about cervical cancer for sure? Well, it has been determined that most women with HPV do not develop cervical cancer. So even if you've been tested and you have an HPV infection, most of those women do not go on to develop cancer. Almost all HPV infections resolve on their own through a natural immune process within 1 to 2 years. The small percentage that is still present at 2 years out from when the initial determination was, those are the ones that need to be concerned about and watched more closely. And what do we know about cervical cancer in women in the United States? It's relatively rare. It is projected there are approximately 3,700 deaths from cervical cancer annually. Now, put that in perspective. There are, in just in women alone, there are more than 67,000 annual cases of deaths from lung cancer and more than 41,000 deaths from breast cancer. And those are annual numbers. So we are injecting 4 million children per year with a series of 3 shots to maybe prevent 3,700 deaths 20 years from now. Is it really a cost-effective and is it really a valuable thing for children in these age groups? The other thing is that the Gardasil vaccine contains 4 different HPV viruses, HPV strain 6, 11, 16, and 18. Strain 6 and 11 are to protect against venereal warts, again, a sexually transmitted problem, probably not seen in 9 and 10-year-old children. Strains 16 and 18 are the HPV strains to protect against cervical cancer. When they originally started deciding which HPV strain should be in this vaccine, because there are more than 80 HPV vaccines and there are more than 8 different ones that have been associated with cancer. So when they sort of narrowed it down and decided which of these two, the 16 and 18, why they chose 16 and 18 was that because they had to do cervical swabs in more than 22 countries around the world to test populations of women and to say what is the most prevalent, most common viral strain that we see out there that have been associated with cervical cancer. On an international basis, the two most common types were types 16 and 18, which were found in somewhere between 22 and 24% of women. In this country, only 3.4% of women had those strains. So now we're vaccinating young girls who probably aren't promiscuous and probably don't have much risk factors. We have no idea how long the antibodies are going to last. They only followed the study for 4.5 years. We don't. Most commonly, women develop cervical cancer somewhere between 35 and 45 years of age, at a period of time when most women are getting annual or at least every other year Pap tests. And we're going to inject all these little girls when only 3.4% of women that were tested in the United States had the virus. So, and the other thing is that if you've already been exposed to those two strains and you've developed a resistance to it, it's come in and it's passed on the way through, like 92% of, like most of them do, over a 2-year period of time, the vaccine will do no good at all. There's absolutely no benefit, and there are no plans to test girls, or as they move this vaccine into an older population, they're now looking at 18 to 26-year-olds. There's no plans to pre-test through a cervical swab to see whether or not they've already been exposed to these viruses before the vaccines will be given.
One of the single most important insights into the relationship between autism and vaccines was a series of studies that were done by the CDC. And the CDC then said there is no association between autism and vaccines. However, there is now a whistleblower from the CDC, a Dr. Thompson, who has come forward and confessed that what he did and what his own co-sponsored scientists did was wrong. They lied, they changed the statistics. In point of fact, there was over a 345% increase in autism spectrum disorder in African-American young children who received the vaccine at a particularly early age. And they covered it up. But let us hear about this CDC whistleblower, vaccination, autism, and the fraud.
Oh, my God, I cannot believe we did what we did. But we did. It's all there. It's all there.
This is a real story of a real fraud.
It's the lowest point in my career that I went along with that paper.
Deliberate, high-level deception of the American people with disastrous consequences for its children's health. In order to give context to the extraordinary story that you're about to hear, a little historical perspective is important. Many of you will have heard of Tuskegee. Dirt-poor sharecroppers in Macon County, Alabama. Black men with syphilis. From 1932, 339 men were told by the Public Health Service, the forerunner of today's CDC, that they had bad blood. The motive of public health doctors was to study the natural history of syphilis in the black man. Natural history in this case means deliberately untreated. These men were deliberately left untreated even when something as effective as penicillin came along. Worse still, those infected were actively prevented by public health doctors from getting this life-saving drug. Men suffered and died. Women continued being infected, and babies continued to be born with congenital syphilis. A shiny new CDC took over in the late 1960s, refused to stop the experiment. Not until every last man had been opened up on their autopsy table. The experiment was stopped, not because the CDC realized the barbaric nature of their enterprise, but because a whistleblower by the name of Peter Buxton leaked the story to a journalist at the Washington Star. The story was published on July 25, 1972, hit the front page of the New York Times, and the experiment was stopped shortly thereafter. Congressional hearings followed. So unethical, so inhumane was this public health experiment that it led to a change in the CDC's code of medical ethics. Except it didn't.
30 years later, the CDC was to do something arguably far worse.
Over a decade ago, Dr. Scott Montgomery and I put forward a hypothesis for MMR vaccine and autism. The age that you receive the vaccine influences the risk. This makes sense. For some infections like measles, the age of infection changes the outcome. We shared this hypothesis with vaccine officials, members of the Centers for Disease Control at meetings in Washington, D.C. and Cold Spring Harbor.
A group of senior vaccine safety people at the CDC studied it.
It panned out. We were right.
At least partly.
By November the 9th, 2001, nearly 13 years ago, senior CDC scientists knew that younger age of exposure to MMR was associated with an increased risk of autism. In 2004, they published, but they hid the results.
It's the lowest point in my career that I went along with that paper. And I went along with this. We didn't report significant findings.
MMR was declared safe.
The IOM has evaluated this issue back in 2004 and again most recently in 2011. And, you know, their conclusion, again, it was not just looking at the work that was done at CDC, but with the total body of evidence, was suggesting that vaccines and their components did not increase the risk for autism.
What Dr. Colleen Boyle, a co-author of that blighted paper, did not tell Congress is that she and her colleagues had deliberately concealed the autism vaccine link from the Institute of Medicine and the public. Ironically, they even received an award from the Secretary of Health and Human Services for this work.
So troubling was the fraud that one of the CDC researchers broke ranks. Eventually, he made contact with Dr. Brian Hooker, father of a vaccine-injured child with autism and a vaccine safety researcher.
I received a phone call out of the blue. It had a 404 area code, so I knew it was from the CDC. Lo and behold, it was Bill Thompson. He had much to confess.
I'm completely ashamed of what I did. I have great shame now. I was complicit, and I went along with this.
Dr. Thompson had appointed me his priest. And when he appointed me his priest, then he started confessing. And we have had many, many phone exchanges. We've exchanged dozens of emails, and he has released quite compelling information regarding fraud and malfeasance in the CDC.
We didn't report significant findings.
Thompson sent Hooker information that was never intended for public scrutiny. From their own data sheets dated 2001, Dr. Hooker analyzed the CDC's results, and he found the same risk for autism that the CDC scientists had themselves identified.
It's all there. It's all there.
He confronted Thompson.
He has expressed significant remorse for lying, for burying data.
I have great shame now when I meet families with kids with autism because I have been part of the problem.
This week, August the 10th, 2014, Dr. Hooker published the real findings. A 340% increased risk of autism in boys receiving the MMR on time compared with those receiving it later. 13 years and tens of thousands of children later. But as I've said, Dr. Montgomery and I were only partly right. The risk of autism from early MMR vaccination was seen in black children, black boys. Those boys, for some reason, are at very high risk. Consistent with the CDC's own findings, the rate of autistic regression in black children is reported to be twice that in white children.
Oh my God, I cannot believe we did what we did.
Tuskegee Revisited. Scientist Dr. David Lewis, an international expert in whistleblowing and the detection of scientific fraud, reviewed the original CDC documents and the paper they published in 2004.
Probably this is the clearest case and the easiest case in which to answer, is it fraud or is it an accident? Is it just an artifact of the study that we're dealing with here? Clearly it's fraud.
He knows that he's culpable for damage. He knows that he's culpable for permanent damage of a large, significant portion of the population in the United States.
The higher-ups wanted to do certain things, and I went along with it.
Dr. Frank DiStefano, Dr. Marsha Lynn Jürgen Alsop, Dr. Colleen Boyle, they knew. They let it happen, and they could have stopped it. Michigan lawyer Allison Folmar, an award-winning advocate for children and parental rights gave her reaction.
I feel, first and foremost, as a human being, you know, betrayed. When you lose your faith and trust in humanity, you know, how do you repair that? I mean, I don't really know what to say, to be honest.
Thompson is very regretful about his involvement.
That's the lowest point in my career that I went along with that paper. I'm not going to lie. Mm-hmm. I basically have stopped lying.
You see, vile as the crimes of Stalin, Pol Pot and Hitler were, these men were not hypocrites. Their motives ambiguous or their rhetoric glazed with apparent caring and compassion. These men were not entrusted with the welfare of their victims. Their mottos did not include the words to save lives and protect. They were not running a mandatory program disguised as caring. How many children? How many went to the wall in that decade of silence? How many presidents, Mr. Obama?
Let us now hear from a reporter talking about vaccines and their safety, and he catches the government lying about vaccine dangers. And he also catches pandering by Senator Elizabeth Warren to a CDC Rear Admiral about vaccines and their safety.
We're going to start this off with a little exchange between Senator Elizabeth Warren and Dr. Shuchat, who works at the CDC. This is what I call the beauty pageant of vaccines. They throw softball questions at the officials, and the officials throw back the canned answers. So let's look at this exchange.
Dr. Shuchat, you are the top immunization official in the United States. I just want to walk through the science on this with you. Is there any scientific evidence that vaccines cause autism?
No.
Is there any scientific evidence that vaccines cause profound mental disorders?
No, but some of the diseases we vaccinate against can.
Is there any scientific evidence that vaccines have contributed to the rise in allergies or autoimmune disorders among kids?
No.
Are there additives or preservatives in vaccines that can be toxic to kids?
No, not in the amounts that they're in vaccines.
Is there any scientific evidence that kids can develop immunity to these diseases on their own simply by eating nutritious foods or being active?
No.
How do the risks of a child responding negatively to a vaccination compare with the risks of skipping vaccinations and risking exposure to a deadly disease?
Vaccines are safe and highly effective, and it's important for parents to know they're the best way to protect their kids.
Parents should know that all of the credible scientific evidence suggests that modern vaccines are safe, modern vaccines are effective, and modern vaccines are our best chance of protecting our children from diseases that can kill them. Is that right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So you heard it from the officials that there's no problem with vaccines whatsoever, perfectly clean record, nothing to worry about. Go out and get your child shot up today, especially with that MMR, right? In fact, I get sent this study a lot. I'm going to read it out to you, so you can go read it yourself. Vaccines are not associated with autism. An evidence-based meta-analysis of case control and cohort studies. Basically, what this has done is three doctors looked at, 15, 20 different studies that all said vaccines are safe. So then they came up with the same conclusion that vaccines were safe. What's interesting is if you go to the epilogue of this study, one of the doctors, Dr. Guy Eslick, says this: as an epidemiologist, I believe the data that is presented in this meta-analysis. However, as a parent of three children, I have some understanding of the fears associated with reactions and effects of vaccines. My first two children had febrile seizures after routine vaccinations, one of them a serious event. These events did not stop me from vaccinating my third child, however. I did take some proactive measures to reduce the risk of similar adverse effects. I vaccinated my child in the morning so that we were aware if any early adverse reaction during the day. And I also gave my child a dose of Tylenol 30 minutes before the vaccination was given to reduce any fever that might develop after the injection. So the doctor in this study admits that two of his children had adverse reactions to vaccines, one of them very serious, yet he still vaccinated his third child. This is because of the intense programming doctors go under by this Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundation-funded medicine paradigm, which is only vaccines, only prescription drugs. That is the only thing that can save you. Nothing else. Herbal remedies don't work. Vitamins don't work. Nothing else works unless it came from a Rockefeller Foundation company or a Carnegie Foundation company. Okay? And that, those are your big pharma companies that exist now. These chemical giants that don't want anything out there natural. They have to synthesize everything because they're afraid of natural competition. Furthermore, in this study, they list all the studies that they look at, one of which caught my eye, and it was a population-based study of measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination and autism. One of the doctors in this, Paul Thorson, MD, is wanted by the CDC for massive fraud. He was taking funds and grants that were supposed to be given to him for research and funneling them into his personal bank accounts. How much credibility can we take in this? And now let's look at some actual studies that are being done that show vaccines do cause harm, quite contrary to what you just saw in the exchange between Senator Warren and the doctor from the CDC.
Vaccines are safe and highly effective, and it's important for parents to know they're the best way to protect their kids.
First article, Activist Post, 22 medical studies that show vaccines can cause autism. And they list the studies down here. They're in the journals of epidemiology, journal of inorganic biochemistry, study in the journal of toxicology and environmental health. These are reputable papers. And all these say there's a problem with vaccines. Yet I guess our CDC officials didn't have time to read these studies because they don't say vaccines are safe and effective.
They're very effective and they're very safe.
Modern vaccines are safe. Modern vaccines are effective.
Vaccine is safe and effective. And
is a safe form of flu vaccine. It's very effective in preventing the flu.
Vaccines are important, safe, and effective.
Vaccines are safe and highly effective. And
here's more. Journal of Biomedical Sciences, the Annals of Clinical Psychiatry, American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences, Journal of Child Neurology, study conducted at Massachusetts General Hospital. You can read the synopsis of each one of these studies, and then it has links to these studies, so you can go read them yourself. I encourage you to do this. Spend a night. Your child's health is worth it. Let's continue. Polish study confirms vaccines can cause a large number of adverse effects. And they say, it is not reasonable to assume that manipulation of the immune system through an increasing number of vaccinations during critical periods of brain development will not result in adverse neurodevelopment outcomes. Doctors and researchers point to the worsening state of health of the child population since the 60s, which coincided with the increasingly introduced vaccinations. Allergic diseases, including asthma, autoimmune diseases, diabetes, and many neurological dysfunctions, difficulty in learning, ADD, ADHD, seizures, and autism, and chronic conditions to which their attention has been brought. Here is another study out of PR Newswire. Infant vaccines produce autism symptoms in new primate study by the University of Pittsburgh scientists. And basically what they did was take the basic childhood vaccination schedule and inject it into baby monkeys. And then they watched them not develop correctly. And if you look around you, go to any public place where there are kids nowadays, you see a lot of kids that are really messed up and not acting like normal kids. You'll see it. Just go out there. Here's more. MMR vaccine isn't safe after all. UK government forced to concede. A UK court has ruled that the vaccine caused severe brain damage in a boy now aged 18 and has ordered the government to pay compensation. Robert was just 13 months old when he had the MMR vaccination. And from being a healthy baby who was developing normally, he started to suffer epileptic fits and became unresponsive. Here's another study. A measles outbreak at a college with a pre-matriculation immunization requirement. In early 1988, an outbreak of 84 measles cases occurred at a college in Colorado in which over 98% of the students had documentation of adequate measles immunity. Over 70, that's 83% of the cases had been vaccinated at greater than or equal to the 12 months of age. So fully vaccinated people were still catching the measles. And they were at a 98% vaccination rate. Here's a Chinese study. Difficulties in eliminating measles and controlling rubella and mumps, a cross-sectional study of a first measles and rubella vaccination and a second measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination. The report coverage of the MR and the MMR vaccine is greater than 99% in the Zhejiang province. However, the incidence of measles, mumps, and rubella remains high. Now let's go back to the testimony of Dr. Shukat over at the CDC, and let's hear what she has to say about what happens if you don't get the measles vaccine and you get the measles. What are the complications that may occur?
Your child contracted measles in the United States, the chances of a death would be about 1 in 1,000?
That's right, but remember, there are other problems with measles, not just that rare risk of dying. There are other complications besides death. Children can get pneumonia. They can get dehydration. They can also get a neurologic problem, encephalitis, which can be quite scary and severe.
So she says death, pneumonia, encephalitis. Coincidentally, those are three things listed in the insert, which they don't show you when you go get your vaccination, of side effects that have been documented with the MMR vaccine. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? Family to receive $1.5 million in first ever vaccine autism court award. It took many years, but this occurred in 2010. It's a young lady named Hannah Poling. In July 2000, Hannah was vaccinated against 9 diseases in 1 doctor's visit. Measles, mumps, rubella, polio, varicella, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, and haemophilus influenza. Afterward, her health declined rapidly. She developed high fever, stopped eating, didn't respond when spoken to, and began showing signs of autism and began having screaming fits. In 2002, Hannah's parents filed an autism claim in federal vaccine court. 5 years later, the government settled the case before trial and had it sealed. Here's what Hannah's parents had to say. Her dad is actually a neurosurgeon, so these aren't just crazy parents thinking that vaccines cause the injury. Here's what they had to say in Good Morning America.
I think the bottom line is our daughter was born normal. She developed normally for the first 18 months of life. There were no signs of any underlying genetic disorder. Then she was vaccinated. She became ill. That illness eventually led to a diagnosis of autism, then later seizures. I think that's the bottom line, and that vaccines were related to her illness.
Hannah's story in many ways doesn't sound that unfamiliar to us. Seemed like a normal child, and something seemed to change, didn't seem to be genetic, didn't seem to make sense. What do you believe the message is out there for other parents?
Hannah's case and as other parents out there hear her story, I think her case is echoed among thousands of other similar cases. And I know a lot of other medical experts are going to get out there and say that this is a very unusual, oddball case. And we don't really think it is at all. I mean,
interestingly enough, if you or your child is injured by a vaccine, you have to go to a special court. And this is a court with no jury. It's got a special judge. It's different rules, and there's no reporters allowed. Nobody's allowed to even see the evidence. It's just presided over in a secret tribunal.
If federal health officials oppose compensation, the case is argued before a special master in the U.S. Claims Court. Many refer to this as vaccine court, though it isn't a court at all, but rather an administrative procedure in which the family asks the government to admit the vaccine caused their child harm and requests compensation for the child's care. Pharmaceutical companies do not have to participate in the proceedings at all. Taxpayers pay for all damages. The U.S. Department of Justice acts as the government's lawyer, with taxpayers footing the bill for their defense. The family's attorney is paid out of the trust fund, administered by the Department of Health and Human Services. There's no required discovery process, so potentially incriminating documents stay hidden in the hands of the vaccine manufacturers. Most hearings are off limits. No public, no reporters. There's no judge or jury. A special master appointed by the U.S. Court of Federal Claims both presides over the hearings and issues the rulings, which can limit the chance of an objective verdict.
Since 1989, this court has awarded over $2.6 billion to people injured by vaccines. Doesn't sound very safe and effective to me. And this is money that you and I have to pay. This doesn't come out of the drug company's pockets. This is paid for by the federal government. Remember that.
I want to thank you all for listening. I hope this has provided some additional insights into an extraordinarily important topic, vaccine safety and efficacy. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.